On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Up on 2 minutes past the hour, this is the Horn Titanic Tuesday. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our home. That's where you'll find the Listen Live button, the chat room button, the PayPal button, the traditional mail address, which, by the way, is the Horn, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB 318, Beckley, WV 25801. Of course, if you prefer to listen on a tablet or smartphone device, we highly recommend the apps TuneIn and Stitcher. They are both quite good for getting your daily Horn broadcast fix. Whatever. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid, and I am proud to announce that we're out of the hole. There will be a broadcast come Monday, and Tuesday, and Wednesday, and thenceforward, hopefully, with no more similar crises like this for a very, very long time. I guess the best way to put this would be to describe things as follows. This and subsequent broadcasts of The Horn for the remainder of the week and up until Monday, which was sort of our drop-dead date, are brought to you, in addition to all of those mentioned last night on the program, by Kath, by Bob, by Tim, by Mike, by James, by Jim, by Ron, by Marty, by Sandra, by Kate, and yes, we had an incredibly generous contribution just a couple of hours ago of $1,000, and until I get permission from the contributor, I'm going to withhold that individual's name, but we're going to take care of a bunch of stuff that might actually bring us to current and take care of and take care of everything that was threatening the existence of this little independent media broadcasting operation. So thank you all. You have created community. Again, you have perpetuated, not necessarily created, but perpetuated community. So, thank you very much. Malin and Kim writing in. Just wanted to say, Malin is at Jersey in the chat room. I just wanted to say hi and let you know that we, Kim and I, sent you the donation from Kim's PayPal account yesterday. We appreciate your wonderful effort to keep the show going. Glad to hear, listening right now, that things are going better now. They are going considerably better, and thank you, Jersey. Thank you very, very kindly. And thank you all very kindly. Because this is a perpetuation of community. It really, really is. And the way you respond to one another, not just in terms of contributions, but in terms of the information that is put out there, is truly inspiring. So we will finish September okay. Marty noting via email, can't live without Moran Monday and prayer meeting Wednesday, and the rest of the days, too. Thank you, Marty. Thank you very much. So we will finish September to the good. We will crawl out of the hole that that we were in that was not occasioned by anything that relates to anything except the ongoing fundraising problems we've had in the past. Thank you all very much. I want to get to a couple of emails here. I have a follow-up here from Karen. We had a fascinating and deeply touching and light-shedding call, the first-time call, even, from Karen last night. She sent me a note and said, greetings from Karen, please share. Dear members of the Horn Family Commune, as a follow-up to our discussion yesterday, I did not mention that there was no resolution to the criminal investigation. Bob, with your legal background, as referenced in other topics covered on your program, I've really valued your insights. After reporting that I had been sexually assaulted in April 2003 on pass in Bulgaria, I remained deployed with my unit in Kosovo until July. The rapists were assigned a different base in Kosovo, so I never saw them again. The whole approach of CID to the investigation, from my perspective, was to catch some inconsistency in my statement with which to discredit my account. It was during the second interview, a couple of days after the rape occurred, that the investigators told me that the two rapists' statements about the night were consistent with each other, while my story was not. They also told me what a traumatic and humiliating physical exam I was causing the two assailants to undergo. My God, we've been here before, haven't we? This makes you wonder if the guys were from Steubenville. I think Karen probably understands what I'm getting at with that. You remember the for-profit media people from CNN bemoaning what would happen to the rapists in Steubenville? Yeah, I think we spent an hour or so on that. I think that was the point, Karen continues, at which I got so angry that the powers that be figured it would be a good idea to lock up my weapon in the arms room for a few days. I know that the account that I gave to all of you in the commune last night was incoherent in parts and amorphous as a whole. Don't be so hard on yourself, Karen. Just as it was 10 years ago when I was interrogated by CID. The investigators got really aggravated when they asked me a question and I stated that I didn't know or didn't remember. I was further questioned by agents from the CID detachment near my unit in Germany several months later. In that interview, I think they lied to me about some forensic evidence they say they had found. Again, I repeated my account of the events of the night at the hotel in Sofia and stated that I couldn't give them a decisive explanation about the evidence they had found. That leads me to wonder how many rape cases are discredited, not because the incident did not occur, but that the victim, not remembering some parts of the assault, lies perhaps even unintentionally just to fill in the details of their statement. The victims get interrogated too. I feel that the CID treated me as if I was wasting their time. After all, there was a war to liberate Iraq going on, and the idea that some courageous American soldiers would do something horrible to one of their fellow service members just didn't fit into the zeitgeist. I realize that law enforcement needs to establish the credibility of accusations, but there has to be a more sensitive way to do that. Well, remember, please, we had the story a month ago of the town, I can't remember in what state it was, Virginia, wasn't it? Was it Virginia? Yeah, it was Virginia, where the default position of law enforcement was to assume that the victim was lying. I think I said at the time that these things don't exist in a vacuum and that statistically, if they exist in one place, there's probably a considerable likelihood that they exist in others. Ta-da! I'm not treating this lightly, but you get my meaning. There was so much, Karen continues, that I didn't understand. The most important thing at the time, for some reason, was that someone would believe me. I told acquaintances that I had worked with about the incident. I was really searching for some perspective and insight. I sensed that it must have seemed odd to those around me that I would tell anyone who would listen about what had happened to me. Sergeant T, a helicopter mechanic and acquaintance from my previous unit, did believe me and provided me with reassurance that what I had told him was plausible. He knew about the availability of the date rape drugs in Sofia. I only just thought of this, but Bulgaria has been literally run by gangsters in the recent past. I've ruled out alcohol and all of the commonly known date rape drugs except for GHB. The impression of being outside of my body, fragmented memories, hotel surveillance video of myself walking with the support of the rapists in the hotel corridors, and information from the CID report indicates to me that I was drugged with some variant of GHB or I experienced some sort of memory loss. I have partial memories of what happened, the most cutting of which was the rage with which these men I didn't know and wouldn't even have bothered talking to if they hadn't also been soldiers, were screaming at me, calling me a bitch. But I don't think I will ever have access to any recollections of the worst of what they probably did to me. I was informed by the Division JAG's victim advocate that nearly a year after the incident that the case was ruled partially substantiated and there would be no further action, i.e., we couldn't prove you were lying. One point that has often been cited in media coverage of the sexual assault in the military has been the low prosecution rate. Service personnel under the UCMJ still have rights if they're accused of a crime. When I get angry that they got away with it, I think of George Stinney. Although my experience with George Stinney, by the way, George Stinney was the youngest person executed in modern American history in the military. Executed while we were fighting the tyranny of fascism in Europe. But to continue, Karen says, although my experience with the investigators was horrible and traumatic in itself, I still don't see how any prosecutor could have convicted the men who raped me on the available evidence. The often repeated phrase, he said, she said, usually makes me want to vomit because to me it implies both parties are just squabbling little children with stories of equal merit. But one doesn't have to be particularly clever or sober in order to follow through a scripted sexual assault, leaving just enough doubt about the issue of consent in order to get away with it. Well, that's what the drugs are for. I insisted that the criminal investigation go forward in order to gather information so that I could form my own judgment and find some peace of mind. The God-fearing, upright Christian commander of my company in Kosovo and CID insisted that there were only two explanations for what had occurred. Either I drank so much that I couldn't remember or remember what had happened to me, in which case a sexual assault had occurred, but I was responsible for what had happened because I signed the statement of conduct before going on leave to Bulgaria that I would drink responsibly. Ooh, that's a stretch. I don't mean the drink responsibly part, but that you can sign away your right not to be raped. Whoa. Or the other possibility was that I had decided to have sex with two strangers and felt so ashamed of what I had done that I was claiming I was raped. Although what the motives for the latter would have been, I guess only a misogynist could fathom. Well said. I was very fortunate, Karen continues, to transition out of the horrible unit I was in during the Kosovo deployment when we returned to Germany. The first sergeant of the new unit confided to me that he had battled depression himself and fought to get me in to see a counselor at the CSH, the Combat Support Hospital, as well as working with my new company commander to get the higher headquarters to assigned me to a rear detachment in Germany rather than deploying to Iraq. At the time, there was a tendency to send problem soldiers off to see a psychiatrist for 20 minutes once a month and then hand them a prescription for antidepressants because personnel for long-term counseling was scarce. Also, the focus of treatment was to return the soldier to deployable status or recommend separation from the military. However, the psychiatrist who managed my case arranged for counseling with a social worker rather than a psychologist. The lady she arranged for me to see was a DA, Department of the Army civilian, who knew very little about the military. It was a breath of fresh air to talk to someone every week who was more concerned about helping me to heal as a person, as Karen, rather than returning Sergeant K to deployable status so she could go off to fight George W. Bush's cluster in Iraq. I managed to make it to my end of service in 2005 when stop loss was lifted. I left with a regular ETS honorable discharge rather than a medical or command-mandated chapter, so at least I don't have to spend the rest of my life seeking ways explaining to employers how I got raped and had to leave the Army. I could go on and on with all sorts of insight about what had happened and pent-up frustration about issues left unexplored over this past year of media coverage, but I think this is enough for now. I can't thank you and the Horn Family Commune enough for providing a forum that allowed me to talk about some issues that I hope people might consider when the subject is addressed. I hope, in short, that this helps someone else. Well, see, I could have begun the program this evening after the good news, and we could have talked about the great speech that President Obama made today. We could have talked about the larger foreign policy concerns attached to whether or not he on our behalf should sit down and try to have a sane conversation with a guy from Iran who is sticking out all the olive branches he can gather up in that nation, trying to make less likely the possibility of a whole bunch of people turning into little more than their constituent parts. And as we know, human beings are far more than the sum of our parts, especially when they've been scattered over a bomb blast radius of some several miles. We could have done that, but I find far more compelling the idea of beginning the program with your thoughts, your ideas, because you, and this is the reason that I find it so important to continue this effort, you make this, not me. And with that in mind, a note from Harry. And this is very kind and very thoughtful. Harry writes from Baltimore, "Although I've not had any real free time or the mental energy to write you in many, many weeks, we worry, Harry, we do. I have indeed been listening to the podcasts or your program for the last few months." Oh, I think that was of your program. Okay. "Although I now have an exponentially more stable housing situation in Baltimore than I did when I was house-sitting that house owned by the woman with severe mental health problems. I moved on May 11th into my present situation. Getting settled here in Baltimore has still been a gradual process. Even having to move twice in 4 months was an almost overwhelming undertaking. And there were many things that I brought with me from Washington, D.C. that I did not unpack or identify which moving container they were in until the end of the summer. Unfortunately, up until now, I've not had a reliable enough internet Wi-Fi signal to be able to listen to the program live. And how I have missed being able to do that. That's also why I've not been able to call into the show during all this time. On several occasions in the last 2 months, I tried to use public Wi-Fi signals to listen live, but always lost the signal within the first hour or so of the show. So I went back to listening to podcasts somewhere between 1 day and 1 week after the show was broadcast live. Believe it or not, I have listened to all of your shows since I was last in contact with you. I developed a system where I would download a number of the recorded shows, one at a time, and then listen to them late at night or early in the morning. Sometimes over a weekend, I could listen to 3 or 4 shows. And I recently caught up to the point that I actually listened to your Monday, September 23rd show about 1 a.m. Tuesday morning. I felt deeply saddened, but also completely empathetic about your pained announcement that you might need to terminate the program on September 30th because of financial difficulties. As you know, I have had my own serious financial distress, starting with my need to leave Washington, D.C. after 24 years in January 2013. And while listening to your podcasts so carefully for the last few months, I eventually began to understand that your own personal life had taken a large hit when the derecho upset your home in West Virginia in the summer of 2012. Frankly, I felt terrible when I heard that many of your home appliances had been ruined and that you were doing your household laundry at a laundromat, all of which is true. So I have myself wondered how your program finances were holding up. I was often concerned that raising money primarily from your listeners' family commune would be difficult because I know that many, if not most, of your loyal listeners do not have a lot of funds themselves. Also true. In fact, although I felt it would be presumptuous, I'd often been tempted to write you within the past month or so and ask if you were seeking other sources of funds. I'm sure you were indeed doing that seeking and are doing it still. Indeed. On the other hand, I understand, if I may say so, your need to make the stark announcement and come to terms with the realities of your financial situation. Fundraising during your program every night must, at the least, be wearing on you psychologically, if not financially. Harry, you said a mouthful. But please allow me, although this makes for a lengthy email, to convey to you how impressed I have been with all of the programming that you have engaged in since the beginning of the summer. First, I wanted to share with you that I have deeply admired the quality of all your programs that I've listened to by podcast. Many, many times I've been so delighted with either a news story that you decided to dissect or a topic that you decided to turn into a kind of incisive entertainment that I thought about writing you and sharing my related thoughts, but I would often realize that the program I was listening to was between several days and several weeks old, so I didn't write. Never let that stop you, any of you. That's the whole point about new media. It is not time-stamped or date-sensitive. We can go back or stay current any way you want to do it. Y'all drive this process. And this is not a matter of me just reading you a letter of glowing, and it is glowing. I shared this with Agnes and told her to go ahead and get the C-clamp out for after the program. Usually I have to stick my head in a bucket of lime water, and then she has to put the C-clamp on for at least a night just to get my head to swell back or to deflate back down to normal size. Harry continues, "But if I may say so, you've had some simply wonderful, simply great segments on many of your nightly shows over the last few months. Indeed, I sometimes sense that you are trying to push the envelope in terms of your own creativity. It happens. I have sensed that you have thought deeply about how to approach even well-known news with creative observations and approaches. At least for me, your programs over the last few months have indeed been highly creative and stimulating listening experiences for me. And so in this new city of mine that I have grown to enjoy, despite my continued work and financial problems, I have still found regular inspiration from your internet radio program. I would not trade away any of your recent programs for what my progressive neighbors and friends here tend to turn on, MSNBC generally, Rachel Maddow, Chris Hayes, etc. The person who owns the house where I now live is a regular TV watcher, and he often watches MSNBC. But I've seen nothing, even on MSNBC or the late current TV, that matches what you've brought to me through your program and through Dr. Bill O'Brien's program. I will share that with Dr. Bill, Harry, and he will be tickled pink to hear it. Did you notice how Dr. Bill brought out the axe handle right at the end of the program? Knocked me down. I think my head's still throbbing. Laborman is in the chat room, by the way, and he was a big help yesterday evening. Thank you, Laborman. Thank you, Greg. This was truly a team effort to keep things going here. Harry continues, "I have empathetically suffered with you from afar, both in space and in time, on the nights when you..." My God, that makes me sound like I've got a starship back here. And you know, when you turn the lights off and it's dark and everything, all the little lights from the equipment kind of make it look like it is a starship. But anyway. Harry says, "I have empathetically suffered with you from afar, both in space and time, on the nights when you've had either small or large technology failures or disappointments. I can only imagine, or perhaps I can't imagine, how frustrating you must have been on those nights when you couldn't do what you'd planned to do. For example, to play an audio clip of Brian Fisher or Michael Savage or those other ridiculous right-wing broadcast clowns that you were just waiting to share with the Horn listeners' family commune. And I've listened with great delight to all your recent experiments with the Friday program. What a delight to bring all the Skype group into the program itself. Those recent Friday programs have been wonderful to listen to, and I've been envious of those who had a consistent enough internet connection to allow them to participate via Skype. So this is all to say, Bob, that I've become aware, more than a little aware, of your financial burden since the summer of 2012, and I have been in some ways profoundly amazed that you have persevered with your program despite all of these chronic financial problems, and how I have wished so many times that a wealthy progressive philanthropist or foundation would come along and give you a large enough sum to allow you to build and further develop your innovative programming, because it is programming that is not only highly creative in its approaches to the events in our society, but is also highly communal and thus socially healthy for anyone who listens." If one reads a book such as The Spirit Level by British social scientists Wilkinson and Pickett, a book that was first published in 2009 but that has now come out in paperback with a new postscript, one realizes, as I have after reading it carefully, how much our society is killing itself by perpetuating the growing inequality of income among people within our one society. The Spirit Level, which studied 23 wealthy nations, shows again and again, both in text and in simple graphs, how economically unequal societies, such as the United States, always do poorly on important social or quality of life indicators. This is important stuff. The specific dozen or so indicators that Wilkinson and Pickett studied were big factors, such as life expectancy, obesity, homicides, mistrust, social mobility, mental illness, and imprisonment rates. And in graph after graph, one sees in their book how the most unequal societies in the 23, e.g. the U.S., the U.K., Singapore, and Portugal, always end up in the worst area of the graph. And in those same graphs, the same countries, those that do indeed have the relatively least amount of income inequality, show up in the best area of each graph: Japan, Norway, Finland, Denmark, and Sweden. The book's authors, Wilkinson and Pickett, conclude that the more equal societies do indeed seem to have societies that are better on multiple levels and for multiple social indicators. Similarly, the most unequal countries seem to do poorly on almost every social factor, although it is not exactly clear, even to the authors, why more equal societies have fewer social problems and healthier citizens. The reasons are easily imagined, I guess. Less competition for status goods and services, less income devoted to collective social services, such as universal health care, fewer intrapersonal and interpersonal tensions around individual needs and satisfactions, and so forth. I note, coincidentally, that I also recently read an essay in the journal Science that discusses an undoubtedly significant but not widely publicized report that the Federal Institute of Medicine issued in January 2013. According to the public health researcher authors of this essay, the Institute of Medicine, for the very first time, has suggested that the growing health problems in the U.S., just FYI, apparently the U.S. is now dead last on almost every international health comparison factor that is widely studied, may be due to structural and systemic problems in the society as a whole. Let's back up and do that again. The Institute of Medicine, for the very first time, has suggested that the growing health problems in the U.S. may be due to structural and systemic problems in the society as a whole, rather than to individual behaviors and individual risk factors. The authors note that just 2 years ago, an Institute of Medicine report still focused on individual risk factors, particularly obesity and smoking. But now it seems there's been a small shift within the federal medical community towards recognizing how our society might itself be causing the worsening health of Americans. The authors note with dismay, however, that the National Institutes of Health still seem to be obsessed with research on molecular causes of disease. So, Bob, I realize that you may be feeling partly responsible for the possible demise of the program. Not yet. Not yet. We know that now. But please know that, if anything, I think your recent programs the last few months have been simply superb, always educational, stratospherically creative, and ultimately compelling to listen to, even at 3 a.m. You know what? If I'm not putting you to sleep at 3 a.m., well, I'm going to tack that one up on the wall. And if you decide that the finances of the present arrangement are just not working out, I will completely understand your reasons. But I hope you will not attribute the problems to either a lack of talent or a deficiency in determination on your part, because I think you've always had both in extraordinary quantities. Wow. Finally, I also feel compelled, Harry says, to say that I myself feel absolutely terrible for not being in a financial position to help you in any way. There have been so many days when I've wished that I myself had received a windfall, just so that I might give a large chunk of that windfall to the horn, so that you could continue to create such creative and informative radio programming. I continue not to watch any television or listen to most public radio, because none of it is quite good enough to satisfy me. Only your programs have given me the combination of erudition and creative presentation that meets my needs. Warmest regards to all. Harry. The printer worked, he said. If the printer worked, I would print that out right now and tack it to the wall for anybody who cares to walk in and wonder just exactly what's going on here. Note from Jan and Jerry in Nevada. Two words. Standing ovation. That's for you, Harry. That's for you. Rob, with a note, the horn lives. Wow, yeah, and what a relief. Yes. And Randy, writing from PA to note, I'm sorry, Bob, but it seems we might be doing yourself in with your absences. Continue with that. Combine that with your not getting in on the Kickstarter craze when you could, and you could have a bad mix. We all have our own personal limitations. However, I'm still sticking my neck out for you. And we thank you. We all of us thank you, Randy, for sticking your neck out like that. Absences? Well, that's a part of it, but it's not all of it. There have been months when I have not traveled a lick, and we've found ourselves in a hole at the end of the month. This is not a traditional broadcast operation. Ed Schultz, once upon a time, who referred to the folks in the Phoenix area who were trying to save progressive radio there, mocked them by calling what they were doing bake sale radio and said that it wasn't real radio like what he did. I guess this isn't real radio either, because it isn't driven by some insane urge for profit. I don't understand people who get into something for the money. I can't. It's past my ability to comprehend. And that has something to do with my raising. You could not now, nor back when I was a kid, could you have gotten me to say that I wanted to do what my father did with his life. Spending every working instant around the very heat like unto the very bowels of hell itself. No thanks. He took me there a few times. It was fascinating to see, but no thanks. Too many stories. Too many calls out to the plant. Like the time when the great big ventilation fan cord was sort of frayed and laying in a piece of, in an area where the concrete furnace floor had cracked and filled with water, and Dad got juiced with a big old dose of 440. Or the night we had to come and take him home from the plant because he had just put out two human beings by tackling them as they ran burning across the furnace floor, the tap room floor, I should say, from having molten silicon metal splashed on them. But regardless of that, my father said, I will never forget this, I hope. My father said, I'm the luckiest man on the face of the earth because I love what I do. And every morning I get up and I say, goody, I get to go to work today. And so, you know, there was never anybody saying, you know, radio, why don't you do that? Well, somebody did say that once upon a time, but that was not the motive. But when I came back to this, it was after talking to a couple of people who'd been in the business for a long time, and one of them, who was fairly successful at it, said, don't get into it for the money. Because radio is not a money business. Molloy has even said on occasion, on air and to me, you know, radio is a great job and a lousy business. And it's true. But it's also true that it is a disease with no known cure. And once you've been bitten, Well, you live with the sting. So this model is not a model of steadiness or security. And if that was the motivating factor behind the horn, I think we would have been gone a long time ago. This is a model of community and communication, kinship, and shared success and sacrifice. It is an exercise in what Gertrude Stein said, that friends are the family you make for yourself. Thank you, Gary. Thank you very kindly. Gary noting, hope you can keep it up for keep it lit for a few decades to come. Labor man again. Thank you. And so, between labor man and Kate. And Marty, we are around $440 to the good this evening, plus the incredibly generous gift of the individual who will thus far, until I hear otherwise, remain anonymous. This is how we get out of the hole and stay out of it for quite a long time, I hope. Let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for the call, buddy.
Oh, Kate!
Yeah, it's me. I thought
you don't never call here no more.
I don't, because I'm on a family plan, and I never know who's going to use the minutes, and so I just thought I would jump in and hope that Verizon doesn't dump me today. It's about this time of day. It usually does. So anyway, I thought I would tag on to Harry's email. Well said, buddy.
Wasn't that beautiful?
Yeah, it was. You're right. Another sycophant in the group.
Now stop that.
And thank you, Karen, for following up on your call. You go, sister. A lot of people can use that information, and a lot of people are keeping secrets, and it's not that keeps us real sick. So thanks for having the courage to share. And I thought that I would I don't know how to go about this, my little socialist rant, because we keep saying words like commune and family and stuff, and even though we tend to get dysfunctional sometimes, like all families do, but when I think of when the family or the commune needs something, that we need to just jump in there and take some grains of rice out of our bowl and throw it in somebody else's bowl. And that's the way socialism works. I mean, all for one, one for all. Isn't that right? I mean, what would Jesus do? So, and I've been here for a lot of years, and I'm not hearing some things that somebody touched on it. I guess it was Harry touched on it with, like, changes that happened a year ago. And as a disaster response person, what I'm not hearing is, I try to listen to the archives, and what I'm not hearing is that the roof didn't get fixed and you're going to be burning propane for heat because of the electricity problems in your house this winter. And winter is coming very soon. And
we got down in the 30s last night.
Well, it was here too in Montana, and
first frost last night.
Oh, was it? Okay, I know they were supposed to get one north of 80 in Pennsylvania. So, anyway, what I'm not hearing is the disaster response from the state or the government or something. And I've never heard you say that your roof got fixed, which tells me, as a person who's used to working around these conditions, that your roof is probably still leaking and you're in dire need of electricity. And if you're doing laundry at the laundromat, then appliances are not back in order.
No. And I hesitate. I mean, I do mention from time to time, Kate, that, you know, it rains in the bedroom. Actually, it rains in the bedrooms.
And you know how, and I respond to that with just rage, because that shouldn't be happening. And it's putting stress on you and your family, and I know you probably don't want to talk about this on air, but I don't care. It's my
You're going to make me, dime. Aren't you?
It's my dime.
Yes, it is. I wait all night for calls like these.
I'm not going to respond to that. I just wish that we could do something about getting you back in shape. If FEMA and the state of West Virginia didn't respond to your emergency, then we've got to do something, you know. And this is where my socialism kicks in, and I just cringe when I know that we've got, every one of us have a little rice bowl, and we've got grains of rice in our bowl. And I'm really impressed with how yesterday and the day before turned out. I lost a lot of sleep last night wondering, oh God, what to do, what I'm going to do. And I scrounged up enough. I can't match $1,000, but my $250 went as far as it could go. And I just wish that we could do something about making a fundraising for putting a roof on your house, you know? I mean, God. And what other concern I have is that if your bedrooms are leaking, then there's mold in your house, and that cannot be good for, I know that Agnes has breathing problems, and so do you, and I have no idea how Ferg and Margie are doing. And you can't have the grandkids there if the house is full of mold.
Wow, you just knocked it out of the park with that last one. That's the absolute truth. We won't let them in.
Yeah. And I worked disaster response too long to know that. I just know that there's, if not all is well at the old place. And I wish that somebody could, we could start a fundraising. I mean, you need a dry house. You need electricity. You're going to run on propane again this winter to heat?
Most likely, yes.
Whoa. More breathing problems.
Oh, I just, you know, I love the smell of hydrocarbons in the morning, Kate.
I know, I do too.
It smells like victory.
It smells like, the other reason that this is so important to me is because I got black mold infected lungs when I was down on my first tour of the Gulf Coast in Pascagoula, and I've still got a cough that I just can't get rid of. I mean, it won't go away. I mean, I've got black mold and lung infection, and that's, you know, I live with it, but you guys shouldn't have to. I've got a roof in my house now. I don't live in my truck and my van anymore, and so I'm more well suited to.
You know, there's a lot of stuff that goes into things like this, Kate. One of which is that for all the genius that my beloved grandmother, born in 1894, displayed. I mean, she designed this house. I mean, down to the last board foot, and she was very proud of being able to do board foot calculations.
All right. I even know how to write that down.
See? It ain't just everybody.
Mm-hmm.
This little piece of property that she bought way back when, it was the middle of the Depression, and I don't know how she came up with the money, but she did. And she bought this little acre, and she situated the house on the highest point. It's fairly level, but it slopes toward the back. And she situated it on the highest point of the ground, which was smart, but back then you dug yourself a basement under the house so as to store all of your canned goods through the winter.
Right. Root cellar.
Yeah, well, she dug into a spring when she built the basement.
Mm-hmm.
Not kidding. And I'm thinking about maybe next spring turning the basement into a koi pond.
Oh, good.
I mean, it's just perpetually wet, and yeah, the mold issue's real, the fungal issues are real. And you know, any minute now, I will get the email. Well, Jesus, Bob, because I get it, you know, once a month or so. Jesus, Bob, why don't you move?
That's not an option.
No, it's not, for a variety of reasons, not the least of which, you know, no retreat.
Right.
It comes with the turf. The roof is in bad shape, and I'm hoping that maybe, November or so, there's no promise here, because I have no idea how to do this. maybe November or so, before the Christmas season kicks in and everybody goes broke, maybe we can crank up the Kickstarter specifically, because, you know, John Fox, chief engineer of the Horn, every now and then I get these notes, these very concerned notes, that generally say something like, Jesus, Bob, we've really got to talk about the equipment.
I know.
We've got shot preamps. The telephone thing is hanging on for dear life, but it's gone. Well, you get the idea.
What happened to that fundraising that we were going to get to name the studio or whatever?
Well, we did that, and I pulled names out of the hat. So the hard drive is named, and I've actually got the list here somewhere. The hard drive is named. The sound card is named. The fan is named.
I missed that program. Okay.
Yeah.
And might I also suggest, instead of putting koi in the basement, you could stock it with catfish, and that way you'd have protein to eat.
Yeah, or Arctic char. I mean, if they can grow them in old abandoned coal mines, ew. But they're bony little bastards. I don't know if you've ever tried to eat one, but there's a reason they don't put them on a lot of restaurant menus, you know, because you wind up having people, you know, grabbing their throats and be like, yeah.
Well, if you had some good channel cat down there, it'd be good.
Oh, it would be tasty.
Good mud cats, yeah. Anyway, so, and also, speaking of John Fox, I just realized, I've been listening to it for so long, that his intro says, brought to you by Coal River Mountain Watch. Well, you don't have that funding anymore, and could I suggest that you change that to brought to you by the listeners, or brought to you by the audience, or the...
I think that's probably a viable suggestion, although... In light of the support we got in the past, I don't ever want to take away a moment from from how they helped us sustain it, and frankly, you know, encouraging people to be part of the struggle against mountaintop removal is something that I always want to keep front and center.
Okay, well, all right, but it's just erroneous information, so I just
That much is true.
Just thought I'd throw that out. Well, I just wanted to talk about people sharing the rice in their bowl and getting a roof on you guys' head, and I know you haven't wanted to talk about that for a long time, and the Oral Roberts thing, I understand that, but why is it our society doesn't like to talk? We don't talk about sex, money, and religion. Well, we do that here, but we don't talk about money. I mean, it's too... that's one of those taboo subjects that you just hate, and I understand that because that's the way you were raised, but we weren't all raised that way, so I'm just saying let's just keep the funding, just keep the money coming in, and maybe set aside a figure, get an estimate on the roof, and set aside a little...
Well, see, we got one of those when the derecho blew through, and as soon as I handed it to the FEMA people, as quick as they got done laughing, they said, no. It's apparently, I mean, if I was to have it done professionally, which means Bob does not climb up on the roof and terrify Agnes.
Step away from the ladder.
Yeah, right, exactly.
We don't want you on the roof.
Or Ferd.
We don't want you on power tools either.
Well, so what you're doing here, Kate, is you are essentially balancing all the good things that Harry said by reminding me of all the things about which I'm utterly inept.
Well, I didn't say you were.
Yeah, I know. You reality spoken here, right?
Yeah. I'm a systems designer, and you don't fit in the system. You could cause a whole lot of chaos by getting on the roof.
And in this chaos, it's not the kind that we want running around self-correcting.
No. What I'm saying is get an estimate and put it up on the website or...
Well, I mean, the fact of the matter is the estimate for the half a roof was $3,000 and the whole roof was $6,000.
Okay. Well, that would be doable if we really went a little deeper into our rice bowls and brought it out, because we've got to get a roof on your house because your family is, you and your family are sick, and this can't be good. And with no Medicare and no Obamacare, we can't afford you guys having respiratory problems, and the stress just probably killing all of you. I know it is.
Stress ain't fun, And I will tell the truth that there's some I think mold related upper respiratory stuff going on. See, unlike professional multimillionaire broadcaster Rush Limbaugh, who will simply gargle into the microphone and get paid for it, I do. I've got those weird little pockets of hang-ups, and one of the things I won't do is, you know, barf up a lung behind the microphone. So, you know, that's what the mute button is for. Some of those pregnant pauses.
We appreciate that, and all these years you've never used the dump button on me, so that's a good thing.
Well, the dump button left here a long time ago, but.
Anyway, well, I don't know. I just wanted to throw that out there and thank everybody for the past couple of days. That's been pretty critical, and we need to keep it going because we just can't let this stop. I remember logging on that day, and there was nothing. The mic wasn't hot, and the horn was cold and out of tune, and, oh, God, it was awful. So I think I'd just step aside and leave you where I found you. And
well, that being the case, we have to play just a few notes of Name That Tune. Kate, on the Front Range, can you name that tune?
Oh, my God, yes. Isn't that Steely Dan?
It was Donald Fagen's first solo effort, but yeah.
Yeah, boy, yeah, he was Steely Dan, right?
He was the Steely part, I guess.
Yeah, we got calls from all over. Like, oh my God, I can't believe you're playing Fagen. Oh, that's pretty cool.
Oh, I remember the night that I got the somewhat frustrated email saying, "Oh, for Christ's sakes, Bob, just play it."
Yeah, instead of bumping me out with it, play the whole song. So anyway, I appreciate you taking this call, and I appreciate everything that the listeners are doing because it's very important what we're doing here. But if we're truly, truly living up to our belief systems, and we are a commune, and we are a family, then we need to pull together and get your damn roof fixed, okay? And I don't know about the electricity. I don't know. I shudder at the thought of you heating with propane, because after Katrina, people are still doing that, by the way. They're heating with their ovens, and they've got roofs that leak, and they've got bedrooms that are wet, and they're sleeping in the living room, and people are dying. I just got back in March from down there, and it's not good. And New Orleans is
no matter. You mean those BP commercials about how everything's back to normal on the Gulf ain't necessarily so, Kate?
I only hear about that on Mike Malloy. I don't know. I don't have a television, and I refuse to watch it. And so I guess whatever BP is doing, it's bullshit. So BP is BS, and it's not. And New Orleans, it's coming back, man. It's coming back. Look at that. Well, no, it's because all the people from up north, or even north of 90, north of 10, come down and buy all the cheap property, and if the person has a deed, if it's not air property, they've got a deed, and they buy it up and then resell it for profit, and everybody's pink. There's, you know, New Orleans is fading really fast, and it's really sad, and they don't have public schools to better build, and stuff. And the most rich, what I'm trying to say, but people with money and resources are
the well-heeled.
Yeah, well, with resources, I guess, and who FEMA, they could get money from FEMA, and they've got SBA loans and all that stuff. They've rebuilt, but
yeah, I'll never forget that day in the FEMA office when they said, "How about an SBA loan?"
Yeah, right.
And then I said, and then how many kids you got? Three. And he laughed. Dude actually laughed.
Mhm. Yeah, it's a joke, and I'm kind of glad to be out of it. I've got a lot of post-traumatic stress. I came home a mess this last time. So, anyway, the things I'm not hearing from you is that we need a roof and we need electricity, because it's getting you guys are living on the edge of a lot of danger with sleeping in wet house with propane heat this winter. That's just not going to wash. So whatever the audience wants to do with that, we could start. I don't know anything about Kickstart and all that stuff, but if somebody who knows more about that than I do, please get on it. Get a man right on it, because we need to do something. So, and thank you for all your support in the last few days. And that's very cool. So,
thank you, Kate. Well, you just got a note in from Jeremy up in Vermont.
And hey, Jeremy, what's up, dude? It's good to hear from you.
He said, cheers to Kate for beating BP and speaking the truth about the Gulf.
Oh God, I don't have enough minutes on my phone.
And then said, FBP, the bastards.
Yeah, really? No shit. I don't have enough time. I don't have enough minutes on this account to even go into what's going on down there. It's pretty awful. So everything that you hear is just crap. Unless it's from somebody who's still got a leaking roof and a wet basement and mold infection, and kids are in a charter school, or there's no grocery store in Ward 9, in the 9th Ward, and you got me started, Jeremy. Thank you. I appreciate your input. So I will leave you here, and have a good show, and break a leg, okay?
All right.
You all kick in, because it's critical. It's getting, we're reaching a critical point, and we get to a point of no return when the roof falls in. So there you go. Oh well.
It's odd how it's easier for you to talk about those things than it is for me. I mean, I'm kind of embarrassed. But being embarrassed about the weather, you know.
Yeah. I'm sorry. I mean, I'm not embarrassing you. It's not, and it's not your fault, and it's not an Oral Roberts thing. But if you can't, I mean, if we are supposed to be a commune and a village and a community, then we need to all get together. I mean, and get together in a circle and have a campfire and
barn raising.
Barn raiser, yeah, right. And there's nothing you could do about the weather and about FEMA turning you down, and I know, because it's an old house and they probably called it deferred maintenance, and we can't do this because the storm didn't really wreck your roof. It was already wrecked, and that's the same old shit they did. It wasn't the flood. It was the wind that did it. You didn't have flood insurance, or you had flood insurance, and it wasn't the water that wrecked your house. It was the wind. Oh, God. Oh, see?
You know, if I didn't know better, I'd swear you had worked from a script.
A script?
I mean, it's almost word for word.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, I got a lot of experience, and I'm...
Well, there wasn't hardly any rain with that storm. I mean, it's just a bunch of wind for a little while.
Oh, God, yeah. And I also have good news for those people who care about my well-being. I not for 90 seconds did ever consider going back to do relief for Sandy, and because it took out some of Queens where I used to live, and I thought, I can't go through this one more time. No. And Malloy wrote back and said, well, they're going to have to find their own Kate for this one, honey. So, and then I am not going, at least today, not going to Colorado for 1 minute, because it's too freaking cold down there. So I just, and whatever. So I'm done with disaster response, unless it's closer to home, and we didn't have any fires up here this winter, and so not yet. So I'm not.
Yeah, but I got a feeling that the next time the remote medical clinic comes around.
Oh,
I know you.
I'm so missing the Smokies. Oh, Jesus, I don't want to go back to the Gulf Coast, but I'm missing the Smokies so bad. So bad. And Ram is, I think, probably running out of money too, because they're not having as many deployments and clinics as they had. I checked the website the other day, and they have usually...
Well, no, Kate, that's probably because, you know, if you check in with people like Senator Ted Cruz, you'll find out that we have the best medical care system in the world.
We do, and it's called RAM, Rural Access Medical, free clinic for everybody, dental, vision, medical, women's health, breast exams, mammograms, vision, everything. It's all free. You know, all they just respond, they just depend on volunteers, and I want to go back to East Tennessee so bad. But you're right, I guess I may just get the bug. I'm sitting on my hands to keep from going to East Tennessee, so there you go. So I'll call before I leave.
yeah, just let us know. Just let us know that the road angels are going to be busy.
that my road angels are always busy. So anyway, I will talk to you again, or keep that money coming in, folks. Please, we need to get a roof up. Okay.
Later. Thank you, Kate.
Look, bye.
Bye now. Yeah, it's an old running gag. I wait all night for calls like these. I gotta do this.
I'm left of the night, why? Hello, Baton Rouge. Won't you turn your radio down? Expect the 7 second delay we use. So you say there's a race of men in the trees. Your buttons, legislation. Thanks for calling. Wait all night for calls like these.
What's not to love about that song? What's not to love about that album, The Night Fly, Donald Fagen? The liner notes to it make clear that he wrote it from the standpoint, it's a thematic album, and he wrote it from the standpoint of a kid, and he hails from the Boston area, a kid listening to his radio and listening to the rest of the world from inside his bedroom in 1950s Boston. And it didn't have to be Boston. It could be anywhere. And I guess I'm one of those kids. Wow. Well, the things you miss. Ron and Raleigh. Hey, Bob, Steely Dan played Raleigh on the 18th of September. Great music for a band named after a marital aid. P.S.B. Dry is a great dry basement company. Offices in Charleston, covering your area. I use them in my crawlspace pool. Dry for 14 years and counting. And that's part of the whole get the estimate thing. And by the way, I guess we're doing the show a little bit in reverse, going to callers first, and then because I got some filibustering to do here in a minute, just because there's stuff out there that's making me nuts. Probably it'll make you nuts too. But we have a little historical perspective to go with it as well. Lines open 304-658-3333. And the Skype line, of course, is Bob Kincaid Horn, BobKincaid. Had a note from Jeremy earlier. He says, I wish I brought more to the tables in answers rather than bitches, gripes, and major effing hates. But yes, more in Mondays, prayer meeting Wednesday, and the front porch Fridays are a must in my little world. Beyond that, I can't go without hearing of all the Horns' trials and tribulations. Congrats to all of the Hornies that helped clear up September's issues. And Jeremy was part of that. Thank you, Jeremy. To the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
You talking to me?
I'm talking to you, Bill.
Well, how you doing, man?
Better than I was last night by a long shot.
Well, me too, because, that's how, this show means so much to me on a daily basis because of the people who call in. And I believe that's the first time I ever heard Kate. I've heard, the name.
Yeah, we used to hear from her more often, but Verizon is, to say the least, not reliable. You know, they run those ads on TV about the broadest blah, 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 blah. No, not for Kate.
Well, I'll tell you what, I had a buddy that got into cell phones about 30 years ago, and he made the executive level to the tune of $75,000 a year. And then all of a sudden, they got rid of him and hired two guys for $25,000 each, and his boss put the other $25,000 in his retirement, and my buddy is now based around Chicago, and he's out there repairing, the rooms at the bottom where all the electronic stuff is.
Yeah.
He's doing that, and he's pushing 60 now. And it's a good wage by, today's standards, but compared with what he made, because he was in on it in the beginning.
You know, you talk, Bill, about people working when they've gotten up in years a little bit. Isaac sent me a story just a couple of days ago, maybe it was last night even, that just blew my mind. And of course it's
find him.
Yes he can. But it comes out of let me pull it up here so I get this right. It comes out of the finance pages. Imagine that, the finance pages of Yahoo. It is originally a Bloomberg story.
Oh.
The headline, Bill, reads, at 77, he prepares burgers, earning in week his former hourly wage. And it's the story of Tom Palome, and says he was pulling in a salary in the low six figures and flying first class on business trips to Europe at the height of his corporate career. But at 77, the former vice president of marketing for Oral-B juggles two part-time jobs. One is a $10 an hour food demonstrator at Sam's Club. The other, flipping burgers and serving drinks at a golf club grill for slightly more than minimum wage. But the thing is, the way Bloomberg Finance News puts this is, it's a happy story because he feels fortunate.
Yeah, he's still working. Gee.
He worked his entire career, paid off his mortgage, put his kids through college, and then turned around and didn't have enough money to live through live anything resembling decently in his old age. So, back into the miracle of the marketplace he went. And, this is a happy story for the Wall Street boys.
Yeah.
I don't know if you realize it or not, but there's a story out there that is just absolutely sick-making. about some Wall Street bankster types. I mean, this is repugnant in the extreme, and it has to do with us proles.
Yeah.
Apparently, we're a bunch of ingrates, Bill.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Because let me see. It comes. Hold on here. It comes, I think, out of. It comes out of Ireland. You might remember several months back we played the audio of these two Irish banksters joking about how they were going to screw everybody coming and going and get a bunch of free bailout money and, you know, F the world.
Yeah.
Well, it turns out that one of the bankster thugs, and this, in this case, AIG CEO Robert Benmosche, Benmosche, he's a little put out, Bill. He's put out at the fact, and this is not the only such reference we have for the evening. He's a little bit put out that people are mad at the Wall Street banksters who wrecked the economy and then stole what was left. He said, and this is a quote, it's over at the Washington Post, "The uproar over bonuses was intended to stir public anger to get everybody out there with their pitchforks and their hangman nooses and all that, sort of like what we did in the Deep South decades ago. And I think it was just as bad and just as wrong." So to recap real quick, Bill, although I know you got it, this guy, who knows, by God, what to do with the shrimp fork, says that being angry at Wall Street for ripping us off and tanking the economy and stealing us blind and you know, damn near sending the government itself into a financial death spiral, that is, and us being mad about that, is just like lynchings in the Deep South.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I mean, this guy, I mean, what's next? Black Like Me Part 2, yeah, by Robert Benmosche? So people, you know, people saying ugly things about him is just like a lynching.
Oh, really?
Classy guy.
Oh, man. Well, see, I just, you know, as old as I am, I'm not going to see what's going to grow out of this constant and chronic depression that I'm afraid the country's going to be in from here.
Or as Sandra calls it, the new normal.
Yeah, exactly. She's on the money with that, because to these people, that's what it's going to be. If they had had their way in the 1930s, that's the way it would have been. I mean, because I don't think they teach people what actually the big parts of the crash and how it happened. Well, we don't know how it happened. Well, somebody does, that's for sure.
But whoever does ain't going to prison.
Yeah, well, not those guys, no. Well, a few of them... There used to be a joke about how my great-grandfather was wiped out in the stock market crash. Yeah, some stockbroker jumped out of a window and landed on his push cart. And that was the pointed story about a poor guy being wiped out in the Depression. Because there was plenty of that going on. Some of these guys, you know, greed and stupidity go hand in hand a lot of the times, you know.
Well, I don't know how stupid they were. They managed to steal every... they turned us upside down and shook out our pockets and got away with it. How stupid is that? I mean, greedy? Yeah, absolutely. No fight there, Bill, but, you know.
About the guys that did go, that did jump and such, how much really was there, or was that just a...
That was maybe a couple of guys did that in 1929, but not... It's not like they were flying off the... Empire State Building or anything.
It was an epidemic then. It was,
no, not nearly enough did.
Well, you used a word tonight that had me smiling. You talked about well-heeled. Well, you know, you say the word healed to an American Detective fan, a story fan. You know what that means?
No.
Carried a gun.
Oh, I'll be damned. I had no idea.
And that's an old expression from that generation of writers.
I thought that had something to do with using the shrimp fork.
No. Well, of course, the other way is wealthy. Yeah, that was one. But the detective authors, when they used it, it was somebody was packing.
Right. Heat.
Yeah, the hired hands. And I just don't know. I found out when I was, well, what happened with, before my eyes went bad, I was running a machine that was a laser-powered metal cutter. And I still wonder about that sometime. Because we had no protection whatsoever. You know.
Well, you know, looking at lasers can be, you know, dangerous for your sight.
Yeah, well, the arcing, the whole place is dark when you're working third. And that stuff was just arcing like crazy. And I often wonder, but who knows? And a buddy of mine owned the shop, and I wouldn't, it's one thing about me, I could never, ever, I only sued one person in my life. It was a delivery kid for a drugstore who wiped out my car at 4 o'clock in the afternoon from behind.
That sucks.
Well, yeah, and if he was like some of the guys I knew. Who,
and were you in it?
Yeah, I was sitting there waiting for a light to change. Bam. And you know what it is, the insurance companies, they want to tell you, well, go find something similar to yours and we'll give you the wholesale price. Which means you're going to lose automatically.
Right. Oh, well, and you do to this day. I mean, that's... that goes...
They're pulling that crap today. So you turn around and you say, you go buy a neck brace and you settle the suit for a fairer price. You know, it should be closer to accurate. What's this wholesale price? Who the hell could buy wholesale? You know, go out and buy a car like...
Yeah, I'm not in the car lot business.
No, exactly.
No, we know. We know a little bit about that here because the perfectly serviceable 135,000 mile, 15-year-old rusty red pickup truck was doing quite nicely until it got rear-ended, and little pillhead that hit my wife and son from the rear in a Toyota RAV4 hit them so hard it not only bent the frame of that big iron monstrosity, it drove it forward into the cab.
Yeah, that's hard to do with a truck. Most of these unibodies, you can forget it, you know. I mean, I had a car I loved so much, I had to frame welded twice, and the third time the guy said, Bill, I can't do it. And he says, because it was a unibody. But we had dumped a...
Yeah, that's the thing. This truck had big old iron frame rails. And...
Yep. See, that's why people were buying pickups a lot, because they were a somewhat safer vehicle. I put a 327 in that Nova, and I reverted to being 16 or 17. 37-year-old guy drag racing up and down Euclid Avenue in the middle of the night with people, you know.
Seems good great place to do that, you know, yeah. Straight road.
Yeah, you go backwards, you know, in time sometime, but... Yeah, I just don't get it anymore, Bob. I just don't know. And these social programs, I have these help aides that come in here. When I have to show them how to clean something, something's wrong. A man has to show a young person how to clean a kitchen counter or something. You know, it's like, come on. And these people are employed by these agencies.
Yeah.
They set up a company. They hire an RN to do the paperwork and to figurehead it. And then they hire a bunch of people for $7 an hour.
If that.
If that. And God almighty, Bob, when I started working in a high school in a knitting factory repairing these machines that were so old, I expected to see a Charles Dickens walk through there. You know, it was the Industrial Revolution machinery making sweaters. We were making that kind of money then, you know. Well, no, not really. I didn't start making seven until I went to work in 70 or 71. I was making that. But, the knitting shop, I started at $1 an hour. What am I saying? I'm losing it. Whole dollar an hour to make. And we sold sweaters to Sears, and the machines were patented in the early 1900s. What a trip that was. But what I loved about it, Bob, there were members of every working class ethnic group in the city of Cleveland. We're working there. You know,
right.
You met a whole bunch of people, and you met them on an even playing field of working. and you learned a little bit about this, that, and the other thing. I've talked to a friend of ours whose name you mentioned earlier about the old folks who had all these dream books laying around.
Yeah.
And I learned about all about the, you know, the numbers racket. I was asking somebody if it still exists. Or does the state own it all now?
I think the state's got it all. But, you know, you just mentioned something. I don't know if you remember that old movie, Logan's Run, or not.
Yeah,
you know,
vaguely, yeah.
Capricorn, 2413, Carousel awaits. And all the little clones would go and get burnt to a cinder when they turned 30 years old.
Yeah.
But Michael York and a woman whose name I don't remember make it through the ice cave and all that stuff. And when they get out into the out beyond the dome, they run into Peter Ustinov living in the United States Capitol. I'm ruining this for some kid who's never seen the movie. Sorry. They run into Peter Ustinov living in the United States Capitol with a bunch of cats. And they sit there and query him about when he starts talking about mother and father, because they had no conception of parents. And in a way, and I'm not trying to make you feel like that circumstance, but you just said something that doesn't get heard very often, namely this. I remember a time when we made sweaters for Sears.
Yeah.
Okay. And that was in Lake County?
No, that was in Cleveland in 1959. I started working.
Okay. So straight, it was in Cleveland. And it was a whole bunch of Americans of different ethnicities going to work at the knitting factory making sweaters that would be sold in the Sears Christmas catalog, you know, with snowflakes and shit on them, right?
Oh, I remember that was a fancy book when I was a kid, man. That was a big thing to look at.
Oh, me too. I mean, I would pore over that. I mean, the G.I. Joes and the Major Matt Mason space stations and whoa, and well, but anyway. You have an actual verifiable memory of that when that don't happen anymore. In point of fact, a couple of days ago, the sewing factory, the textile workers in Bangladesh tried to get these corporations who are, you know, they're so compassionate and they're so concerned about workplace safety to pony up what they had promised that they would do in terms of living wages. And the cops came out and turned the guns on them.
Oh, yeah. These guys are pulling stuff that hasn't been done here since the days of the Pullman strike. And
guess, wonder why it's over there now instead of here. Well, they couldn't do what they did at Haymarket or the Pullman strike.
They had a hard time doing it. Well, Blair Mountain was something I had never known anything about, Bob. And I thought I knew American history strongly, but I had never known about that fight.
Yeah. And so naturally, in classic Ayn Rand and Milton Friedman fashion, they've moved the work overseas so that they can shoot the workers when they get uppity.
Yeah. And you mentioned Rand. There was a lot of fights across bar tables, verbal arguments about her. There was a bunch of people who liked her then, and the rest of us who thought that she was one step ahead of Stalin. And poor Stalin, he missed out on that one.
Well, I always loved what my one buddy said about Ayn Rand. And that was, say whatever you will about the Bolsheviks, but they got rid of Ayn Rand.
Well, they were smart. Well, you know, I mean, there's so much there that World War II in the 30s and 40s, that wasn't that long ago, Bob. I know how people think. That was a long time ago. Not really. A generation and a half or two generations, that ain't a long time.
No. 17 years had passed for my father from getting home from the Second World War when I came along.
Yeah.
So that always provides me a little bit of, you know, much-needed perspective.
People couldn't understand what the baby boom was about. If you had gone in the service in 42 and come home in 46... And you had a sweetheart or a wife. That was a pretty normal thing, wasn't it? All of a sudden, kids were being born like crazy. Because what else did you have to do? Well, gee, what other pleasures were there? I mean, I was telling a friend of ours about the girl, you know, working in the shops, and some of the older guys giving me the business because I was the youngest guy there, and and he was talking about the ladies, you know. He was maybe 18, 19-year-old kid. And I said, well, what happens if you haven't eaten for 5 days? And you come to an oasis, and there's a big pile of the most exquisite food you ever saw. And then there's a beautiful woman standing next to it. And I'll leave you with the guy's punchline. Looked at me and said, can I eat later? When you're a kid my age, you learn.
All right, I can't let you leave it at that.
Okay.
So this guy is marooned on a desert island.
Yeah.
You know how these things start.
Oh yeah.
And he's been surviving as best he can. And one day, this beautiful woman comes walking out of the sea, out of the surf, onto the beach, and looks at him and says, "Been here long?" And he says, "Been marooned here for I don't know how long." You know, he's got the whole, you know, Robinson Crusoe beard and everything.
Yeah.
And she unzips a zipper on her wetsuit and pulls out a cocktail shaker and some of those little airline bottles of booze and says, "Well, you want a drink?" And he says, I haven't had a drink in I don't know how long." "Sure." And so she mixes him up a martini and hands it to him, and he quaffs it down, and he said, just so happy. And so a little bit more time passes, and she says, "So you probably haven't eaten." He says, "I've been eating coconuts for I don't know how long. I don't know how much more I can take." And she says, "Well, you want a sandwich?" He says, "I'd love one." So she unzips another part of her wetsuit. You probably know this. And pulls out, you know, a little package of luncheon meat and some bread and a little packet of mustard and stuff. Fixed him a sandwich. He's just blissing out. He's eating a sandwich. He's had a drink. And then she reaches up to the center zipper of her wetsuit and begins to pull it down and says, "You want to play around?" And he says, "Don't tell me you got golf clubs in there too."
Yeah, I knew. I could smell when you said around. I knew it was coming. Yeah, that's. There are some guys who probably would rather play golf, I guess.
Well, I mean, I don't think I wouldn't have told that if I thought it was terribly sexist. I'll probably get emails now telling me how sexist it was. But
no, it's a reflection on a emotion.
It's about the guy.
Yes, it is. Well, there were so many things that were like that that would point a finger at men in situations, and it was a sensitive subject. But when that finger pointed at the guy, you were looking at a complete moronic idiot.
And the thing is, I've known those guys.
Oh, hell yeah.
You know, the golfer types with the, you know, it takes a couple of martinis at about 9 o'clock in the morning to make the gin yips go away. Yeah.
Yeah, Bob, I didn't start bowling until I was in my 40s. Or fishing until my late 30s. So, you know, when you're a poor kid, you...
Well, you're all set for golf now, Bill.
No thanks.
What did Mark Twain call it? A good walk spoiled.
Walk spoiled, yes. Well, all I can remember is working on my car in the backyard, and my first mother-in-law would turn to my wife and say, "Does he have to talk that way?" The air was blue, and then her son, my first wife's youngest brother, best car mechanic I ever saw. Just about, he went to diesel technician school. And Christ, him and a buddy of his did a clutch on that Nova for me in an hour and a half with no air tools. Couldn't believe these two guys. All I did was fling tools at them and stay out of their way. And the next thing I know, when my young brother-in-law was back there working on his car, I could see her putting her finger in her ears. He's talking the same way I did. There's something about having a wrench in your hand and you're leaning on that socket. The damn thing slips and you bang your hand into the engine and you're bleeding.
Oh, I'd rather get punched in the nose than bust my knuckles.
Yeah, knuckle busting is. Now you're a West Virginia guy. The way you're talking, you're a little afraid of some of this. I don't blame you for roofing. Roofing, you need a roofer. Go down to the closest bar. You'll find.
Oh no, I've done roofing. I did it for 2 summers during college.
Man, that's a miserable job.
It was a hellish, you know, for the whitest man in North America, short of Johnny and Edgar Winter.
Yeah, that was
me
that.
On a roof.
Oh, yeah.
Please,
I've known in roofing were like,
I mean, I'd get done with with work at the end of the day and walk by the lobster tank in the grocery store and go, "Cousin."
Yeah, that's a. I remember my first wife and I went down to Hilton Head. She wanted, and it was a nice vacation, except for one thing. me riding a bicycle with no shirt on. My back was so, I was so sunburned, it was killing me. You know, you get, you've been sunburned.
Oh my God, it's a different world, and us us pale people.
Yeah.
Well, we went on the Libboat cruise, 3 years ago?
Yeah.
And I was 3 hours in the sun on Grand Turk Island without a hat.
Oh, man.
I looked like, I looked like, Captain Pike from Star Trek after the radiation accident, you know, with everything but the little chair with the three lights, you know, beep, beep, beep. I was cooked. And you know, didn't mean to. Wasn't trying to be stupid about it. You know, I had everything but the pith helmet.
Well, down there in the island down there, you be riding along, and there's a stream of water next to you. And you look over, and there's two eyes watching you. And I'm thinking, man, if I lose control of this bike, I end up in that water.
I'm lunch.
Exactly. Exactly, but things change so much. I was listening to there's a radio station out of Canada. It's on the other side, Windsor. And they were talking, asking people remembrances, and people were calling in about a place that was up there, a small amusement park on an island, and you could take a boat out of Detroit for an hour cruise down to this Bablo Island, and it's gone. All these things, these amusement, it's a private island now. You know, it's not...
Well, of course it is. We don't want the hoi polloi.
Well, you know what? When I say Johnson's Island to you, what do you think of? In Sandusky Bay.
I don't know if I know it that well.
Well, if you ever go to it, it's a Confederate officer's prison in the Civil War.
Oh, okay.
It's a cemetery, and there's a statue of a guy gazing south with his hand shading his eyes, you know? But now that's a private island also. Cemetery and all.
The
national park and all, it's a private, they're buying everything they can.
That reminds me of something. It was last summer when I got to go to the old state capital of Alabama at a place called Cahaba, which sits at the confluence of the Alabama and the Cahaba Rivers. And there was a Confederate prison there.
Yeah.
And a whole lot of people survived it. And at the end of the war, they were put on a steamboat and sent upriver be repatriated, and the steamboat blew up in the middle of the river.
Yeah, I remember hearing that one. Yeah.
Hey, Bill, good conversation.
Well, maybe with one question. What,
sure.
Oh, it just hit me, Andersonville.
Yeah.
Did you ever read that?
Yeah.
Yeah, great book. Anyway, good luck tonight, and thank the people who contributed, because, man, I'd have to find something to do, and I'm getting so senile, I can't think of anything to do anymore, you know? I play chess against the computer, and I get wiped out so quick I want to smash the computer into pieces. Take care of yourself.
All right. Thank you, Bill.
Bye.
Bye now. Mr. Stress, our very own Bill, calling from Cleveland. Onward we go. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bill, you mentioned, Bill, Bob. Too kind of am having Bob.
No worries. Hey, Jeremy, what's happening?
You got to speaking to Kate about BP and, I really wish you would see some of those commercials. They're comical to the point that you want to punch the TV.
Oh, no, it's an Elvis gun moment. I've seen them. Luckily, if you go looking around on YouTube, you will find some BP parody ads. And they're genius. The real kind.
I'll have to go checking those out. All I know is the newest one with the... now they've moved from the African-American guys down there to the plain white guys again, and how he talks about, we found two blow-up protection devices, and we strive for nothing but safety. It's our top concern. And again, the same old, the Gulf's fine. Never mind, the oil was still there. We got rid of it. You can't see it. The lobsters are great. The clams are great. The shellfish is great. And the whole time, you just want to bite your lip and almost cry or laugh. You have to be one of the two.
Oh, yeah. No. I remember. And everything's great in New Orleans. And it's best in Alabama. No, Mississippi's the best. And please.
No, and things like Gasland 2 review those BP commercials to the T, because even there's a lady who I have seen interviewed in two different things. One was Gasland, and one was that 60 Minutes thing from the UK that talked about the BP destruction. And she basically said that all the Louisiana people that she knew that were catfished or whatever for generations. It stops now.
Yeah, check this out. I think you should be able to hear this. Let me just run this real quick, Jeremy. Stand by.
Sure.
There are high school dropouts. There are undocumented workers. There are people I wouldn't invite home for dinner. These are the small people on the Gulf Coast who DB doesn't give a about. I'm Darnell Williams. I oversee DB's disinformation campaign on the Gulf Coast. DB has got to keep making money, and that's why we're here. Part of that responsibility is making you believe we're going to make it right. We're decimating the income of fishermen, small business, and anyone else who refuses to work for us pretending to clean up the spill. Our phony claims line is not open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. People cannot call or go online, so that our 9 people here may prevent you from pointing blame, collecting a check, or not giving us your firstborn son. Working with the government, high five, Obama, we're already denying tens of thousands of claims. We've pretended to create a $20 billion claims fund, which is sinister, and since we're killing everything that lives in the ocean, it's at 100% cost to the taxpayers, human race, and elf and fairy kingdoms. I've never been to Louisiana, but I do like Cajun fried chicken. I'll be here in the Gulf as long as it takes me to finish this 3-piece white meat combo.
Thought you'd like that.
That was worth push the part about we don't give a beep about the people down here.
Yeah, we don't give a... No.
And that's sadly the truth. They should really play that right on CBS every night, and people would probably believe that more than the commercials. You know, and then it was mentioned in very small blurbs on all the national news about maybe 2 months ago, where BP said, nope, we paid enough, we're done paying, we're not helping you guys anymore, even though they said from day one, we'll be here to help you as long as it takes. Now they're trying to dictate when time is.
Right. And if you're not better, well, it's too bad. I mean, you should be better by now.
We've already paid out $200 million to help these fishermen. That's enough. We don't need to pay any more, even though we've done billions in damage and untold damage to the ecosystem in doing what they've done.
Yeah, the nerve of some people, right?
Right. And then the switch topic.
Moochers. Is that what we're looking for? Moochers.
Yeah, all those people, they destroyed their lives. They're all just moochers, so you can't forget that. I mean, they're just using the government toll and everything else. But you were talking to Bill about that the guy who was working a couple jobs now just to get by, making like a half of his salary he used to make.
He made in one day what he makes in, you know, a week, 2 weeks now.
Right.
Well, at 77, what happens if you say, you know, I want to go see the grandkids? Well, you're okay, you're fired. But then again, he probably doesn't have the money to go see the grandkids, so screw him, right?
No, because that reminds me of back during the good old Bush days. When Bush was, I think, he was on a campaign trail.
Minnesota.
Or on vacation, because he was always on vacation. He never really worked. That was all Rumsfeld and Cheney anyway. But, when he told the story about a couple different people working 2, 3, 4 jobs, saying... Well,
yeah, it was in Minnesota. A woman came up to me today, and she said she had 3 jobs. And I said, you know, that's uniquely American. Still makes you want to kick furniture, doesn't it?
I had 3 jobs as a 21-year-old, and I hated it. I can only imagine working 3 jobs in my 30s now. I don't think I have the energy to do it, honestly. But I can't imagine being 50, 60, 70, and I see it all the time. Even here in little Vermont, I see people who are 65-plus bagging groceries, working overnights at... We have a major chain around here called Price Chopper.
Welcome to Walmart. I love you. Yeah.
Well, Walmart greeters, Walmart stockers, cashiers, all older people. And then, we're speaking of Walmart again. Joy, I just remembered the other story from just this past month of Sam Walton's oldest, longest living worker who died penniless.
Yes. No pension, no health care.
Years.
Hey, you ought to just be glad you got a job.
Right. So, and that story did mention how he was buried. If the heirs put up money, it was probably like $100 for a pine box in a shallow pit somewhere unmarked.
That's considered generosity.
But in their case, they probably just threw him in a cornfield, let the wolves take care of him.
Buzzards, really.
Anyway. Yeah. So I sent my little message earlier. I really don't have any answers. I just have bitches and gripes, but...
I understand, but they need to get those need to get out there too. Listen, I'm suspicious. I mean, you've heard me say it before. There's a trend at a couple of websites to title things these days: five things you need to know about, or 10 things you have to know about, or should know about. You know, and that makes me a little bit crazy, because as a progressive or a liberal or whatever it is. You know, I don't need to be told what I need to know.
Right, I agree with that. I think we all do.
And as such, well, I don't know. There's something anti-authoritarian about me that says, you know, don't tell me. I mean, okay, 10 things you need to know if you're a diabetic. All right, I'll buy that. But 5 things I need to know about what a booger eater Ted Cruz is? No. And so consequently, what I was getting at is, if anybody, I'm deeply suspicious of anybody who says, hey, me, over here, look at me. I got the answers. Because at that point in time, I'm going to become highly suspicious, brutally paranoid, and probably not much interested. No.
And this is why you're not a Beck fan. Because he has all the answers, short of it's the Kenyan Muslim hatred of all white people president we have in the office.
So, no, I mean, don't feel like you... Never feel, Jeremy, like you're under some obligation to bring answers. Because
I don't have the answers.
If you had them, you'd probably have a job with some think tank in Washington, D.C., especially if the answers you had involved old people not eating. That'll get you a job. And if you can say that old people shouldn't eat because Hispanic people are stupid, well, I mean, that'll get you a corner office at the Heritage Foundation.
Yes, it will, sadly. But I guess I'm done with my little speech for the night, so I'll let you go, but have a good night, and congratulations to meeting.
Well, I don't think
you need it so quickly.
Well, I'm deeply grateful and truly inspired. I don't know if it's quite a congratulations kind of thing yet, but what I'm proudest of is the fact that we'll be here Monday, and we will see our anniversary on the 24th of October.
And I didn't mean that we're done. I just meant congratulations to everyone for beating back the wolves at this point. It's a never-ending story, obviously, but you seem to keep it going one way or another.
Yeah. It's the last fraying thread on a worn out shoestring.
All right, Bob.
All right, you take care, Jeremy. Have a good evening.
You too. Thanks.
Bye now. Jeremy calling from Vermont. Onward we go. Hey, welcome to the program.
Well, this is a first for me. I'm calling you tonight on my cell phone. All the home phones died.
Oh no.
I don't know. I'm assuming they're not charging properly or something, but I was sitting on the first time I called, I got disconnected. Second time I called, I was on hold for about 10 seconds, and the phone died. So I decided that was enough for me, and we're going to switch to the cell phone. I know I can get out on that thing. So, but while I'm thinking about it, I want to pass on a message to Bill I got a message the other night on Twitter from Isaac to Bill, and I just want to let him know that I'll be getting in touch with him probably tomorrow. Some things come up tonight that I've got to do, so. So I want to pass that on. You there?
Yeah, I'm right here. Good deal. And I know Bill heard you.
Yep, I'm sure he did. And, you know, listening to Bill talk about the things that are past, I listen to a lot of old-time radio programs. Just about every night I listen to a station with some old-time radio programs on them. And, you know, it has changed. And when you talk about you came home from the hospital 17 years after World War II ended. Well, I came home 14 years after World War II ended. And being our age, especially when we're little, World War II seems like, oh, so long ago. You know, it was before we were born.
And yeah, well, I don't know about you, Kevin, but for me, it was always ever present.
Yeah.
And it was ever present, you know, not just because of my dad, but because of my mother. Because both of, you know, my father had gone and served in the military, and my mother, even though she had a scholarship to college coming out of high school, didn't, and instead went to the Eastern Shore of Maryland and worked in a munitions factory.
Yep. It was for me in the sense that my grandparents, who went through the Depression and both wars, both World Wars, had that, you know, saving all the time, don't let anything go to waste kind of mentality, which, you know, we have too in a different way. But I can remember a time where we didn't, where I didn't have that mentality of trying not to let anything go to waste and save not only leftovers, but, you know, just about save plastic. I save plastic bags now. I've got like 100 of them. From the store, I recycle them. And, you know, 20 years ago, I wouldn't have done that. You know, it's plastic bag, throw it away. But now I save them, one, for the recycling, but two, for the fact that, you know, it makes a good wrapper for something where I don't have to spend money on aluminum foil or plastic brand wrap or things like that.
Sure.
And
again, that comes from having the parents you had.
Yeah. My parents weren't as bad as my grandparents were. But, you know, they went through that. They went through World War II. They were young, 4, 5, 6 years old, up to about 8 or 9 before the war ended, but young enough that they remembered.
Sure.
And now we're being forced to do that again for an entirely different reason, for the corruption and the greed of the 1% that's been forced upon the other 99% of us. And it doesn't have to be this way. I think Malloy played the clip last week, and I got it through an AAE Americans Against the Tea Party email yesterday about the professor up at Duquesne University that died homeless and alone, 83 years old.
Yeah, I think, we did that story Friday, I think. And That was just, well, horrifying. And they're trying, and the guy who wrote the story, his name, last name is Kovalik, oddly enough, himself an adjunct professor at University of Pittsburgh, but also has a job within the Steelworkers Union, and is working on keeping those horrors from happening again.
Well,
but it's all over the country.
Oh yeah, and I got a real kick out of the the head person at Duquesne who said that the union was exploiting, massive exploitation of the woman's death. Well, now, let's think about it.
Wait, what? What?
They said that the union was exploiting the professor's death.
Oh, God. It's just like what happens after another mass shooting. Well, they're politicizing these people's grief.
Right. So.
No, we're trying to make sure that more people don't have the grief.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just a really sad thing. Commentary on a couple of levels to me. One, the fact that she was an adjunct professor making that little per semester. Two, that I don't know how many people really caught on to. She's 83 years old and still working. She should have been enjoying her retirement. You know, do you hear that old saying about people enjoying their golden years? And
well, see, but that's another one of those phrases as outmoded as High Button Greaves, like middle class, Kevin. That's something we used to say about Americans reaching the end of what was deemed their reasonable work life. In other words, at being at 62 or 65, being able to knock off and enjoy a little time to themselves before shuffling off the mortal coil. I think that's as useless a phrase now, golden years, as middle class is. What middle class? Bullshit. No middle class, Kevin. You know, like I said, there's those that work, those that used to work, and those that don't work and never will.
Right. And, you know, I just, the fact, the university said they also supposedly reached out to the woman, and she didn't want charity.
They threw her out of her office when they found out she was napping in it. I'm not yelling at you, you know that.
Yeah, I know. I mean, they threw her out of her office, but they fired her, essentially. She was a contract worker, but they fired her, essentially, because they found out she was attending the meetings to form the union. And then she becomes homeless and sleeps in her office, and then they throw her out of the office. Well, I couldn't live with myself, Bob, and you couldn't, and all the Horn family couldn't. If we had an 83-year-old that was working for us and we found out they were sleeping in their office, I see no way possible that I would say, you know, why don't you come stay with me? I have a one-bedroom tiny apartment, but it's better than sleeping in your office, you know, kind of thing.
Right.
And it's just, that's the part that really upset me. And then, to say that you don't need the union. This is why the people need the unions. If you treated the people like human beings, they wouldn't have been talking about forming a union. And they seem to miss that one little fact, but it just really bothered me on that level, that at 83 years old, it's like the burger flipper guy up in, what was he, Ohio?
I don't recall right offhand.
It's like him, 76, 77 years old, working in a burger joint because he lost his job.
No, because he did everything right.
Right, exactly.
Because he worked his ass off, earned a nice salary, but apparently neglected to note that he was still a working person, and that's something that happens to people who earn in excess of six figures. They think that they're not a working stiff anymore, that somehow they get to hobnob with the gold-plated shrimp fork folks. But I mean, that's not something you can indict him for. On the other hand, the guy paid off his mortgage, the guy sent all of his kids to college, and then he didn't have enough to live on.
And that's point of it. I'm assuming he must have some sort of retirement from where he worked.
You would assume, but he may have been wiped out in the crash.
Exactly. You know, and I know a couple people when I can't think of the name of the company now, but when one of the companies was wiped out, they were wiped out.
Right, and see, the thing is, this is a story, and it's similar, Kevin, to stories about people who have health insurance and have been financially ruined by a heart attack, a stroke, a cancer. We're talking about people who did things right. We're not talking about what the right wing considers the moocher poor. Remember when they cheered at the idea of just letting someone die on the emergency room floor back during the pageants in 2012? Because I do.
Yeah, I remember that very well.
These are people who have played according to Hoyle.
Yep.
And have still lost out.
Yep.
And so if a guy who was making low six figures, who was a VP in the corporation, and not a wee tiny little crappy corporation either. This guy worked for Oral-B.
Yep.
Pays off his mortgage, sends all his kids to college, and then can't survive.
Yep.
What does that say about all the people who worked for a living with their hands or their backs or lifting or heaving and didn't have any kind of a meaningful retirement through, say, a union or something? What does that say about the number of people who are absolutely going into grim, miserable death and get to the point where they're praying for it? You know, that poor woman in Pittsburgh just wanted... You know what? She wasn't saying, make them give me back my job. She was saying, please tell the Adult Protective Services people not to come and take me away.
Exactly.
Oh, and Bill just dropped an email. He said to tell you thanks.
Good. Haven't forgot him. I just wanted to make sure he knew.
Yeah, and great line coming in from Jan and Jerry in Nevada. Golden years. Bob, there's no golden. There's nothing golden about the golden years except our pee.
No. And my caregiver, her grandfather, kind of an adopted grandfather, went to the hospital yesterday, 77 years old, got cancer, had a leg amputated last year. He went into the hospital yesterday because they had trouble waking him up. Well, to make the short story, he basically told them, let me go home. You know, what can you do for me? You can't fix me, so let me go home. If I'm going to die, I want to die at home. And I'm sure, I don't know this, but I'm sure part of what he was looking at was those bills that would accumulate from it. He's got military, the retired from the military on TRICARE. Well, you still got deductibles with that.
Sure. And you know the story out of Chicago from last week?
Which one?
The 95-year-old... what's his name here? John Rana. Now, this guy was 95 years old. He was living in an assisted living facility. And a Second World War veteran.
Yep.
And was right in his mind, pretty much. And they wanted, they thought he had a UTI, and the doc said that, your age, fixing, you're probably not going to survive it. So they were trying to compel him to go to a doctor. And he said, I don't want to. I don't want to. So that's when the staff, the paramedics, actually, I think it was, said that he threatened them with a shoehorn and a knife. The knife is disputed. And the SWAT team was called in. The SWAT team then shot him with a shotgun beanbag.
Yep.
Wrecked his internal organs, and then he did go to the hospital and thanked his loved ones and said, thanks for everything you've tried to do. I love you. And died.
Yep.
Because in America in 2013, Kevin, we call out the SWAT team on a 95-year-old who is deemed to be, and this is another one of those Orwell weasel words that has entered our vocabulary, non-compliant.
Well, Dad and the 107-year-old, I think he was down in New Orleans or somewhere down south.
Yeah, gunned him down.
And what part of... It's 107 years old. How much of a threat can a 107-year-old be? I don't care if he's got a gun or not. If he's in a locked room by himself, he's eventually going to do something like fall asleep, forget that he's there or something,
Yeah.
You don't have to shoot a 95-year-old or a 105-year-old with non-lethal beanbags or not.
Well, this non-lethal beanbag certainly turned out to be rather lethal.
Sure. And, you know, there was a story the other day on our local paper. Police down here did it right. They just waited the person out. Calmly went in when the person got distracted. Didn't even have to use a flashbang. They just waited, you know, with that camera they used, they just waited till the person was distracted, busted in, arrested him, end of story. You know, nobody got hurt. Nothing happened. And that, unfortunately, is not the norm anymore. And so when a 95-year-old grabs a shoehorn and threatens somebody, if I were the paramedic, now, if the knife were there, maybe. But that being disputed, I'm betting it wasn't there. So if he's threatening me with a shoehorn, I'm not even calling the police. You know, what's the point? Just calm the man down or wait for your partner to get behind him or have some of the nurses come in there with you and restrain him. He's not going to hurt anyone with a shoehorn. Why?
By the way, Kevin, they tasered him first.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, what would a taser do to a 95-year-old? You know, I'm surprised he didn't have a heart attack then and there.
He was days away from celebrating his 96th birthday.
Yep.
And a World War II veteran.
Yep. And this is a thing that is also absolutely shameful, is the way we treat our veterans today. You know, again, one of the Tea Party stories I got, Americans Against the Tea Party thing, emails I got was, how many veterans are going to be kicked off food stamps? And as a veteran myself, I don't think I should necessarily get any special privileges for being a veteran, but when I was in, we did have some sort of benefits to fall back on when we were in service. And then when we got out, of course, I was surprised to get it, but I got some not pay, but I got medical care through the VA because of my eyes and that. And for a lot of these kids with the Iraq War, since about the 85 or so onward, these kids are going into service and getting out with absolutely no benefits whatsoever. If they happen to be wounded or something, yeah, they get care for that. But it's not like it used to be where you were a veteran and you got free medical care for life if you did 20 years. And if you were a prisoner of war or wounded, you got free medical care for life. We don't have that anymore. So the least we could do for our veterans is maybe make sure they don't starve. But that would be the least we could do for all the American people. Stop spending so much on the war machine and put it in domestic programs where it's helping people. And it's just, you know, we all know the stories. And we just got to keep pounding it home.
Yeah, with tongue firmly in cheek, Ron and Raleigh just wrote and said, Bob, 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 it's about time these decrepit, useless eaters, these teat suckers, get off their collective asses and contribute something to the economy. There you go.
Yeah.
I mean, because unless it's a teabag, you know, teabaggers say get the government out of my Medicare, but if it's somebody else, do it. No, see, and they're useless eaters, and that is the real triumph of right wingery in this country. We've created a class of people who, instead of being happy with someone else's success or being happy about the idea of having a socially responsible nation that doesn't, you know, taser 95-year-olds or gun them down or let people starve in the streets, think, well, you know what? If they starve, it's God's will.
Yep.
Hey, Kevin, you have yourself a good night.
Bob, you have yourself a good evening, and I just want to comment, Kate, on her call. I very much liked the analogy of the rice and each other's bowls. And, you know, I'm hoping we can do that. The other thing, if you could pass on to Kate, if she's willing, if you could pass on my email to her, I'd like to see, you know, if there's anything I could do as far as working in emergency response. I may be limited because of my eyesight, but essentially I'm just sitting here playing on the computer most of the day, and I really want to do something constructive. So, you know, if there's anything that she might suggest, I would appreciate it. So,
okay, I'll do that. I'll reach out to her.
Yep.
Kevin, have a good evening.
Thank you very much.
Good to hear from you.
All right. You
bye.
Too.
From Colorado Springs, that's our buddy Kevin. Onward we go. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hello?
Hello, Edward.
Yes. Well, I'm so glad you had a good trip to Waco and West and all those places. Oh, and I've been to Belton and all those places. I know exactly where you were talking about.
Oh, that little barbecue joint was awesome.
Well, I just wanted to tell you, you talked about the Brazos River.
Mm-hmm.
I have been swimming in the Brazos River.
The lukewarm waters of the Brazos River.
Well, not recently.
Now, if this devolves into a story where clothing was optional, Edward, you know, you're just gonna you'll continue to bat a thousand.
Well, no.
Okay.
There were other people out there, and
there's always somebody out there spoiling your fun.
Yeah, well, you know, in Texas, you always don't want to frighten the horses. And I'd scare the hell out of them if I got nude in front of them.
How did I know this would devolve quickly? That's beautiful.
Well, anyhow. Oh, and I want to tell you, I was watching Chris Matthews. Who used to call him Tweety Bird?
Everybody. And I think we still do. Although I think he got a memo somewhere along the way saying, you know, Chris, tone it down a little bit. You're getting ridiculous. That or they shot him in the neck with a Thorazine dart. I'm not sure which.
Well, he was in high gear today talking about Ted Cruz. And I must say, I am the first person I know of that the minute I saw his face, well, when he was running here and for senator here in the state of Texas, I thought, that guy looks like Joe McCarthy, and he sounds like Joe McCarthy. And that's what Tweety Bird was saying today. He said he looks like McCarthy and he sounds like McCarthy.
And it's the truth.
It is.
He's creepy.
Oh,
please. I think we can start referring to him as Ted Creepy Cruz.
That's wonderful. I love that. Ted Creepy Cruz.
Yeah, and that's creepy spelled K-K-K-R-E-E-P-Y.
Well, you take care. And I'm sorry I can't remember the person called in with the quote from Gertrude Stein, friends are the family we choose for ourselves.
That was actually me, Edward.
That was you?
Yes.
Well, Lord,
it's one of my, favorite lines.
I was probably in the kitchen. Well, that's...
It's true, though, isn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, you take care. I'm glad you had a good time coming to Texas. Oh, by the way, I used to visit this lady in Texas. She had a big house and had a courtyard in the center, and in the center was a swimming pool, and it was in the shape of a heart. And I always wondered about that, but because she knew I was gay and all that sort of stuff, but and I swam in the pool shaped like a heart, but she never jumped on me or anything like that.
Well. Thank heaven for small favors, maybe?
Well, you know, Lord, that probably turned me into a trisexual. Take care.
You know, I quit riding my trisexual when I learned to pedal a two-wheeler. But, no, never mind.
Well, you know what a trisexual is.
No.
They'll try anything.
Oh, okay. Live and learn. Edward, have a good evening.
You do, too.
Bye now.
Bye.
Well, that was a perfect segue. That's Edward calling from Dallas. That's a perfect segue into something that I have here. Ted Cruz. Ted Creepy Cruz. You know, he was doing his best Mr. Smith Goes to Washington impression this evening. By jinkies, he was gonna have a filibuster to save America from Obamacare. And you've got to... It was Lewis Black, wasn't it? It was Lewis Black who said, Republicans suffer from Nazi Tourette's syndrome. So earlier this evening, we had the pissed off Wall Street fraud merchant who thinks that people saying ugly thing about Wall Street fraud merchants is every bit the same thing as a lynching in the Deep South. And I'm still having a hard time with that. But over at TPM, they were covering Tail Gunner Ted's creepy filibuster. And I don't know why it is that I'm shocked by any of this stuff, but there it is. This quote. If you go to the 1940s, now he actually stood up in the Senate and said this where other people could hear him. This is a guy with an education from Harvard and Princeton. I think, in fact, that there are old classmates now who are showing up to talk about what an absolute dick Ted Cruz was while he was in the Ivy Leagues. At one point in law school, he said he refused to study because it's a very social thing in law school. You get your study group together, and if you're really sharp, you'll sort of glom in on the ones who look like they're really smart. And you study for a while, and then you go drink beer and lather, rinse, repeat. So Ted Cruz apparently declared that he would no longer study with anyone who didn't go to Harvard, Princeton, or Yale. He didn't want to be studying with anybody from those lesser Ivies. I didn't know there was such a thing as a lesser Ivy. Cassie, if you're out there, dear, you got a lot to work off in Ted Cruz. Hopefully you'll maybe replace him in the Senate one of these days. Princeton's got a lot to work off in Ted Cruz. Karmically speaking, mind you. So really, on the floor of the Senate of the United States, he said, if you go to the 1940s, Nazi Germany, look, we saw in Britain, and I'm reading this real slowly because it's a little bit stunning to me. If you go to the 1940s, Nazi Germany, period. Look, we saw in Britain Neville Chamberlain, who told the British people, accept the Nazis. Yes, they'll dominate the continent of Europe, but that's not our problem. Let's appease them. Why? Because it can't be done. We can't possibly stand against them. And in America, there were voices that listened to that. I suspect those same pundits who say it can't be done, if it had been done in the 1940s, we would have been listening to them. Huh? Then they would have made television. They would have gotten beyond carrier pigeons and beyond letters, and they would have been on TV, and they would have been saying, you cannot defeat the Germans. Word salad for Mr. Cruz. Extra bullshit dressing. Now remember, this whole thing is predicated on the 1940s. I know our buddy Jim knows when World War II officially started. September 1, 1939, wasn't it? But But Ted Cruz, I almost said Ted Knight. I don't know why. Maybe because I'm thinking of Judge Schmales. If you go to the 1940s, Nazi Germany, look, we saw in Britain Neville Chamberlain, who told the British... This guy strings sentences together like Godzilla from Wasilla. No, can I just point out here for just a little moment that there were people in this country who adhered to the idea of going along to getting along with the Nazis. They were people like Henry Ford. And then there were the people who weren't just going to go along to get along. There were people who were actually going to work with the Nazis to make them bigger, better, bolder, stronger. Like the Bush family. Prescott Bush, father of George H.W. Bush, was busted under the Trading with the Enemy Act. He was working at a little brokerage house then called Brown Brothers Harriman, which was the seedy front group for an outfit called Union Banking Trust, which was the pass-through for a whole boatload of money that was being funneled over to a man named Fritz Thyssen, who was known lovingly as Hitler's Angel. Das Engel von Hitler? I like to try out my German once in a while. So, yeah, there, and almost without fail, the people who were playing footsie with the Nazis were Republicans. Charles Lindbergh was famously quite taken with Mr. Hitler. Thought he was just the bee's knees. He was a Republican. But don't anybody tell Ted Cruz or tell the Princeton History Department that nothing they taught him really took. So we've got this word salad here with an extra side of bullshit dressing. But we also have something that I lovingly refer to as history. We have, in point of fact, British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain saved for all digital eternity, or until the Bilderberger Rothschild Illuminati massive electromagnetic pulse takes everything out. Neville Chamberlain, speaking to the British people on the third day of September, 1939, and... You are there. Lay it on, Nev. In a minute.
What a bitter blow it is to me that all my long struggle to win peace has failed. Yet I cannot believe that there is anything more or anything different that I could have done and that would have been more successful. Up to the very last, it would have been quite possible to have arranged a peaceful and honorable settlement between Germany and Poland. But Hitler would not have it. He had evidently made up his mind to attack Poland whatever happened. And although he now says he put forward reasonable proposals which were rejected by the Poles, that is not a true statement. The proposals were never shown to the Poles, nor to us. And though they were announced in the German broadcast on Thursday night, Hitler did not wait to hear comments on them, but ordered his troops to cross the Polish frontier the next morning. His action shows convincingly that there is no chance of expecting that this man will ever give up his practice of using force to gain his will. He can only be stopped by force. And we and France are today, in fulfillment of our obligations, going to the aid of Poland, who is so bravely resisting this wicked and unprovoked attack upon her people. We have a clear conscience. We have done all that any country could do to establish peace. But a situation in which no word given by Germany's ruler could be trusted, and no people or country could feel itself safe, had become intolerable. And now that we have resolved to finish it, I know that you will all play your part with calmness and courage.
Neville Chamberlain would be dead a little over a year later. But does that sound like somebody in the 1940s saying, appease Hitler? Because that sounds like somebody saying, we will fight the Germans until we have defeated the Germans. In fact, I think that's kind of what he said. Until we have finished it. Ted Creepy Cruz thinks that Winston Churchill was the first prime minister of ever. This is kind of what happens when you quit teaching history in meaningful fashion. This is what happens when David Barton, great pal of the Beckerhead, gets to define what history is. According to Ted Cruz, who, despite having been to Princeton and Harvard, and despite being hailed as a leading intellectual light of the new Republican Party, new with electrolytes, what plants crave. Apparently didn't realize that the British entered the war on September 3rd, 1939. I don't care how much he complains, he cannot be heard to complain that he is being taken out of context. We are just up to our eyeballs. We are swimming in context here. If you go to the 1940s, Nazi Germany, look, we saw in Britain Neville Chamberlain, who told the British people, accept the Nazis. Yes, they'll dominate the continent of Europe, but that's not our problem. Let's appease them. Why? Because it can't be done. We can't yada, 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 yada. And then something about inventing television, which, well, the Germans did. Shh. Then they would have made television, they would have gotten beyond carrier pigeons and beyond letters, and they would have... Now I understand, he didn't realize that they had the radio box back then, and so Ted, nor none of his, I'm sure, the absolutely stunningly brilliant, never studied with lower Ivies people in law school staff, well, they just didn't go to the YouTube because they didn't realize that anytime Neville Chamberlain said anything, he just stood out on the stoop of 10 Downing Street and yelled, and the town crier repeated it. F me. Man, there's a great day coming. I wonder if there's anybody in the Senate who at present is thinking, I'm just waiting for my opening. Because everybody is going to know what I'm getting at when one of these days, when Tail Gunner Ted sits down and I stand up and I say, Senator Cruz, have you no decency? At long last, sir, have you no decency? Everybody's going to know. Everybody's going to make the connection. Oh, wait, Joe McCarthy is back. Only dumber. Joe McCarthy at least had a middling excuse of being a damn drunk. Me, I think Ted Cruz is probably just huffing airplane glue. 25 minutes past the hour, lines open, 304-658-3333. or on the Skype line, Bob Kincaid Horn. And away we go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
And away we go.
I conjured you.
You did.
Are you running screaming around the room at this yet, Jim?
No, nothing makes me run screaming around the room anymore, as I told you once before.
Well, more's the pity, but yeah.
More, you know, nothing really surprises me, really. I mean, you know, it's a strange thing when you look back at history and what was going on with, well, for example, Chamberlain. I mean, the guy did the best he could. As a matter of fact, the last meeting he had with Adolf Hitler was at the Berghof, and Chamberlain flew for the first time in his life because he was deathly afraid of airplanes. He just didn't like that. He was very uncomfortable, but he had to go. And then, of course, he came back waving that piece of paper. I think it had something to do with the German-Anglo agreement or whatever.
And the Declaration of Peace in Our Time and the umbrella. And, yeah, that whole image is unforgettable, but that ain't up in the 1940s, Jim.
Well, this was in 38.
Yep.
I believe. When
the Munich Accords?
Well, this is even after Munich. I mean, you know, Hitler.
That's true.
I mean, Hitler basically was, when he was at Munich, and, of course, he commented later that he saw his enemies and they were worms. And even Ribbentrop was very upset with Hitler about signing this thing. And as they were descending the steps of the building in which the declaration was signed, Hitler told Ribbentrop, and this was overheard by one of Ribbentrop's aides, he said, I have no intentions of honoring this. So he was just going to play along and play along and play along, which he did masterfully.
Yeah, and string it out until his war machine was ready to roll.
Well, yeah, it was pretty much...
I mean, September the 1st, 1939 had more to do with the military preparedness of the third of the Wehrmacht than it did with anything relating to a diplomatic situation.
Oh, yeah, but, you know, people marked September 1st, 445, when Case White was enacted, and away the Panzers went over the Polish border. But, you know, World War II really didn't begin then. It began back in the middle 30s with the Japanese incursions. And,
well, and you can argue that it has its roots in the conflict between the Soviets and the Japanese in Manchuria.
Yeah, they did. One thing Zhukov did, he beat the hell out of them at Hocking Goal, that's for sure, and then realized exactly they weren't exactly running over Chinese people fleeing with their rice bowls. But, yeah, Zhukov definitely had a lot to do with that situation. But going back to this thing with Adolf Hitler, I mean, he was just such a masterful deceiver. But basically, anybody who had any sense could realize what he was up to. I mean, in this country, you had the German-American Bund. You had it centered at Yorkville and that part of the New York area, which was extremely pro-German.
You had the father of a sitting Supreme Court justice, who was the head of the Mussolini fan club, also living in New York?
Well, yeah.
I mean, it wasn't just a fan club. It was the, you know, pro-Mussolini fan.
Well,
a fellow by the name of Scalia.
Yeah, well, a lot of people were in, you know, of Italian and German descent and ancestry who admired what the Duce had done, and they admired what Hitler had done, and this type of thing. But, you know, you even had summer camps for youth in New York and in New England. One was called Camp Friedland, Siegfried, and the other was, I can't remember what the other was the thing, but that was Fritz Kuhn and the German-American Bund. And you had a lot of pro-Nazi elements in this country at the very grassroots level, because they just admired, you know, what the Führer had done between 1933 and 1939. And, of course, Fritz Kuhn was later in prison because he was embezzling funds and stuff like that. And I think he even claims to have met Hitler at the 1936 Olympic Games, And even Hitler didn't want to have anything to do with him. He just said, I don't need this.
He could spot a rounder.
Yeah, I mean, Adolf, you know, realized this guy could hurt him more than help him because he was causing a lot of problems, and I guess he wanted his own program to be his own unique product. But nonetheless, it's just, you know, it's just incredible how this thing slipped into being. Well, it didn't slip into being. It was basically engineered by a lot of well-meaning people. And I'm going to bring one example, which is a beautiful film. If you haven't seen it, The Remains of the Day.
Oh, yes.
And Lord Darlington. And, of course, he had his friends like Oswald Mosley and the Black Shirts and things of that nature. And they were, you know, very much enchanted with the fact that Hitler put everybody to work and stifled the trade unions and done all this kinds of stuff, and there was no dissent from Germany. Everybody was working and having a good time and going on these excursions and the Strength Through Joy movement, you know, like on liners like the Wilhelm Gustloff. Remember that story about that boat?
Oh, absolutely.
And, of course, those boats were later interned, and then, of course, when the Wilhelm Gustloff was sunk evacuating German refugees, it was one of the largest disasters in naval history as far as loss of life is concerned. And also, one other thing, I realize I'm sort of jumping around here, and I hope you'll excuse it, okay?
Jump away.
But, I mean, you ought to read the documentary about the Nazi version of Titanic. Oh, that's a real good one.
Wait, what?
The Nazis had a specific movie that Goebbels had agreed to. I can't remember the director's name. Selfien was his name. And it was the Nazi version of Titanic. And, of course, you know, Goebbels, as propaganda minister, always kind of felt inferior because he had a lame leg and he couldn't fight in the war, so he was going to be a soldier of propaganda. And so he budgeted tremendous amounts of money for this Nazi version of Titanic. And basically, it was okay in the 1940s when Germany was winning the war, when they were talking about, you know, the ship being torpedoed, and they inserted their own hero character, a German officer who was telling Captain Smith not to do this and not to do that, which led to the disaster. But nonetheless, Selfien was kind of a roundabout guy, and he had made the mistake of making the wrong comments about the German war effort. And of course, back in 42 and 43, when it stopped going their way, and, you know, in the movie you can see people just jumping over the ship and stuff like that, and the boat going down, then Goebbels, when he first saw it, said, you know, this is not a good propaganda tool at all, because basically this is reflecting our own regime, because that's exactly what had begun to happen to Germany. And, you know, when the tide of battle turned after Stalingrad particularly, and even though they spent millions of marks, and they even had one ship called the Arconia, which was to represent the Titanic. And later, of course, it was torpedoed too, and took a lot of people with them. I mean, this guy was given so much money by Goebbels that they were trying to do this, but even when after it was cut and Selfien was called back to Berlin, and they put him in prison and he hanged himself because he had made bad mistakes about the regime. He just didn't do that. He was betrayed by a friend, I mean, apparently. I mean, they went back and forth. They went all over Poland. They went all over Eastern Europe, which was in their property then, to make this movie. It turned out to be so bad that it was never allowed to be shown in Germany.
Little known history. I had no idea.
They had no. Goebbels would not let it be shown. It was shown in the occupied country.
Well, lo and behold,
and
Beth,
also in the Titanic movie with Kenneth Moore. I'm sure you probably remember that, Kenneth Moore, and there's been several movies made, you know, about the Titanic. They even used footage or film from the Nazi Titanic as backup footage for that movie.
Well, you'll be interested to know, Beth just sent me a link from down in Dallas. The entire movie is on YouTube.
It is.
And so I know I've got something to watch tonight.
Well, I think you'd find it interesting because basically, you know, I guess in the when things were going well for the Third Reich, and it would have been a great propaganda tool for Goebbels. Goebbels specialized in, well, he did two others. One was called The Eternal Jew, which never really sold very well and was not well attended. But he did one called Judas, which was a real big hit. But, you know, these people were so powerful back then that they were able to take valuable military assets and use them as extras. And as late as 1945, Goebbels had done one called Kohlberg, which was, you know, with Eisenhower fighting Napoleon and this, that, and the other. But it's just amazing how they realized the value of propaganda, and they used films to do it. And like I say, even within months after Kohlberg was finished, I mean, the Germans were finished, they were gone. But even when they could have used people to have fought the Russians in the East, they were using these guys as extras and stuff like that. It's just crazy. I kind of go on with the board there, but you know.
Oh, it's interesting though that you mentioned using actual soldiers as extras, because
oh yeah, and one thing about Selfien, who was doing Titanic, he didn't like uniforms and stuff like that, and they used German sailors as assets. And when they took the Arconia to represent the real Titanic, which by the way only had three stacks, Titanic had four, even though that was a false one. They were using these German sailors, and that boat was used to train U-boat commanders and U-boat personnel. So, I mean, Goebbels was able to divert so many assets to make these films that would never really have the effect that he wished, that they really shot themselves right square in the old foot.
Amazing.
But, you know, I feel sorry for Chamberlain. I mean, I think the man did the best he could at the time when he was doing these quick flights to Berchtesgaden, to the Berghof. The man was dying of stomach cancer. Died in 1940.
Yeah, a little over a year after the declaration of war.
It just broke him. But like I say, there were a lot of people in the British Isles and in America who really thought that Hitler was a good idea. And it's just amazing, and I'll say this and get off here, but the 1939 Nuremberg rally, its theme was to be, and this was weeks before the invasion of Poland, the Party of Peace. And of course, when of course Poles heard about Chamberlain's thing that you just played, they were extremely happy. But no such no effort was undertaken. I'm confusing myself with Chamberlain's final thing when he says, if we have not heard from the Germans by 11 o'clock,
the state of war will exist.
And as of such, no undertaking has been received. It was 1939 was certainly a very...
And how long was it before the Wehrmacht chased the British and the French off the continent at Dunkirk?
Well, June 12th was the date when Rommel, I think, placed his boots right there on the shores of the French coast. And the invasion was so fast with the Wehrmacht and Guderian and his panzers, even Hitler was upset and tried to hold back, because you know what they were doing with these huge pincer heads was basically exposing their flanks, you know, when you go in like an hour, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
and they were worried about, you know, being attacked from the on their flanks. But the really bad thing that happened in 1940s was when that big Belgian fortress fell with all the paratroops and stuff like that. I'm not very vocal tonight. You have to excuse me. But, I mean, it showed just how fast Blitzkrieg worked and what they could do.
And the idea of Blitzkrieg was born out of the fact that the von Schlieffen plan theoretically still would have worked in 1914 had it been executed with enough personnel fast enough.
Trouble is, they had the Russians in the east, and the Russians were the ones who defeated the Schlieffen plan, because when war was declared back in World War One in August 4th, you had all these Cossack hordes going toward East Prussia, and the Junkers, and they were already upset with the Kaiser because the name of the game was Cossack Incoming. The Cossacks were coming. They had to, transfer enough divisions to stop 6 million Russians that had mobilized in less than a month or a little more than a month. So, I mean, all these well-planned military executions and things like that have their problems. But nonetheless, when Hitler decided, and he had planned Case Yellow, I think it was called Case Yellow, which was a war against the West after the defeat of Poland, but the weather kept holding him up. And so, he had so many different types of drop-dead dates on that thing. But when the spring came and the weather got good, that's when Rommel and Guderian and von Manstein and all of his field marshals and Paulsens really let go, and they did quite a job on the French. My God in heaven, if you've ever read William L. Shirer's The Rise and Fall of the French Republic, that's a good book to read. It's just as telling about that.
Well, Shirer and Manchester are two of my favorites for that era.
Yeah, really. And it was just incredible how quickly the Nazis were able to overrun France, and the northern part of France for the time being was under German occupation and in the Vichy regime under Marshal Pétain. And things were pretty rough going for the British in 1940 because they stood alone against Adolf Hitler. I mean, we weren't involved in it. Stalin had his non-aggression pact with Hitler until 22 June 1941. And the British were just basically hanging on by a thread. And I can never forget the courage and the determination of that sceptered isle.
Well, I love the remark of Winston Churchill when he said, Mr. Hitler has said he will wring our neck like a chicken. Some chicken, some neck.
Yep, he did. I'll tell you, the Nazis really thought they had something going then. But, it's just amazing. Because, for example, on June 22nd, 1940, Hitler was at Compiègne, right? And he was there in the boxcar, or not the boxcar, but the very train car where the Treaty of Versailles had been signed. All right, June 22nd, 1940. And he was at the top of his game, and he was very happy. He was even sightseeing on the 23rd of June in Paris.
Yeah, that's where we get the footage of him walking around and smiling and slapping himself on the side of his jodhpurs.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess if I had been Adolf Hitler, I would have definitely felt the same way. But, time has a way of eating away, and within less than 5 years, he would have shot himself 2 months before in his own bunker. It's just incredible how quickly time passes and what it does and what can happen in the space of 4 or 5 years. So I guess that's my comment about people who make mistakes about history and interpreting it and wanting to...
And at the, in the final analysis, that's exactly what happened here, Jim. You've got Ted Cruz, who is, again, bruited about as some sort of intellectual of the right wing in this country, who blathers about the transition from carrier pigeons to television.
So that man's just absolutely crazy. I mean, he's just nuts and he's just stupid. The trouble is, people like that have some type of way of getting into power and trying.
Well, if you're a Republican, being nuts and stupid has a nasty, nasty way of being transformed into being called senator.
I'm afraid you're right.
The list is lengthy, to say the least. Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, Rand Paul, Kelly Ayotte, Mitch McConnell, and until he decamped and moved into a corner office at the top of the Heritage Foundation, Jim DeMittit of South Carolina.
Oh, he's a real sweetheart.
Coburn, Inhofe.
I don't know where these men learned their history, and I don't know where they learned their politics, but God only knows that it's beyond my realm and scope of comprehension. It really is. It really is. I just don't understand these people and what they're trying to do and what their ultimate games are.
Well, I for one, question the admissions policies, however many years ago it was, just as we did with Dim Leader. I question the admissions policies of any school that would let Ted Cruz in. And I mean all the way from Corpus Christi Community College to Princeton and Harvard. I mean, this guy's, I mean, nuts.
You know, as far as personnel actions are concerned, I consider several dates in history in which truly Satan existed and had his foot in certain things. The first is in which the first slaver left for the Congo to bring back these people from Africa and treat them the way they did. I know Satan's feet were definitely on the deck of that ship. And I could cite several others, but I mean, the next one that comes to mind was that business in 2000 when they put George W. Bush in the White House. Illegally.
Well, we all have Justice Sandra Day O'Connor to thank for that. I mean, sure, Scalia is a partisan, Rehnquist was a partisan, Slappy Thomas was a partisan, whoever the other one was, but it took Sandra Day O'Connor, who had staked out territory as some sort of an above the fray, for the most part, moderate Republican. She's the one we have to thank for that. So if Satan had boots on the ground, he was wearing her robe.
Well, I think she has admitted that she made a mistake. If I'm not mistaken, even she realizes that it was the wrong thing to do. And Al Gore was cheated out of what was rightfully his. And that's one of the saddest days in my life. I wrote him a letter, and I sent it in. He received it through Nick Rahal, and I just said, you know, dear Mr. Vice President, I have trouble even resolving this intellectually, but I want to say this to you. Politics is a sea. It bathes many shores, and I hope that the waves of that particular body of water will carry you and your family to a safer and more honored place in history. And within 2 weeks, I received a letter from Al Gore with a signed photograph and everything. I've got it framed right over my bed with all my other stuff, you know. I call it my I Love Me wall. And
everybody needs one of those, Jim.
Yeah, I will never forget that. I mean, and that was the worst thing in the world for him. I mean, he was just robbed of that election. He really was. And I knew he must have been feeling real down. And I called Nick Joe and I said, look, I want him to get this or I'm not going to vote for you. And he just laughed. He said, Jim, he'll get it. Don't worry. He said, we feel the same way. So that's all I have to say for this evening's conversation. We've gone the whole gamut from Mr. Chamberlain and his efforts toward maintaining peace and people who basically sided with the wrong people and I just wish we could learn from some of these mistakes that have been made in the past, but we just don't.
Well, I wish the Republican Party could learn to quit comparing everything they don't like to Hitler.
You know, I don't understand that either.
I mean,
if anything is Hitlerian in this country, it is very much taken out of Adolf's playbook.
From the big lie, you know, Iraq attacked us on 9/11.
Yeah.
Sure.
I mean, everything. That's what I'm saying, you know, the big lie. I mean, Goebbels once said, you know, hell, don't tell little lies because people get caught in those, and then you get yourself in an ass in a crack with that. But if you tell a lie, you got to tell one that's so damn big and so damn tremendous that nobody can ever question its veracity. And that's been, you know, that's
And Iraq attacked us on 9/11 was sure enough a big-ass whopper.
Oh, God have mercy. You see where we've gone since then. We've just gone right down the, right down the well hole, really, with that financially and politically and every other way. And
everything that Osama bin Laden said he wanted to accomplish with September 11th came to pass. And it came to pass because we had a president who did not have the common damn sense that God gave a gosling.
Well, he played right into Obama's hands. So that's exactly what Obama wanted him to do.
Osama.
Osama. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Freudian slip there.
Understood.
But nonetheless, I mean, you know, yeah, we attacked a secular nation that was preserving basically interest in the Middle East that were in, you know, concomitant with our own, and he had to go into that, and then he had to go...
Because he tried to kill my daddy.
That man's stupidity, my God in heaven, I just can't, you know, every time I think about it, my stomach just turns...
Eight straight days of swilling rot gut liquor, and you wouldn't be that dumb, Jim.
Hell no.
I mean that as a compliment.
I mean, thank you, but I mean, if I had been Bush, I'd have been realized, look, Osama is trying to sucker me into something we don't need. Even his daddy, Bush 41, told him not to get into it. It's the reason he stopped right there, because he knew that, you know, the preservation of Saddam was essential to
everything there.
Hegemony, and exactly, and also the continued efforts of putting all these troops on Saudi soil and being listened to. Yeah, the whole thing was just a real snafu, a real what we call in the military a Charlie Foxtrot or a clusterfuck.
There you go. Jim, have a good evening.
Likewise. Good night.
Bye now. I knew I would conjure Jim, and he came through. And there's just a little bit of a postscript on all of this. It is one thing to sit here and note that Ted Cruz is dumber than a bag of hammer handles. He's dumber than the bag. And I guess we can have our fun with that. But let's understand that he was acting because he had been gooned upon for weeks by House teabagging Republicans for being a cheese-eating surrender monkey, because he said there was no way to stop it in the Senate. So he was savaged for that. So then we get this. And so when Ted Cruz stood up to speak in the Senate of the United States today, he did so speaking for, yea, verily, millions of Americans. Teabaggers, John Birchers, Klansmen, skinheads, Aryan Nations types, and, of course, the broad subheading for all of the broad overall heading for all of those, Republicans. And they endorse these words. Even as we speak, there are little right-wingers out there prattling about what a goddamn statesman this freak is. And they are doing so because, and this is the takeaway. I'm doing my own little Dr. Bill impression, just, you know, bringing out the axe handle in the last couple of minutes of the program. Right-wingers and teabaggers and so forth are throwing flowers at this creep's feet because he stood up in the Senate of the United States today and compared people who want to be able to go to the doctor when they are sick without being bankrupted to Hitler. Just nail it all the way down to the ground. That's what he did. He compared people like me. I take this personally because I make no bones about the fact that I'm really looking forward to having some health care. Ted Cruz took to the floor of the Senate today and compared you and me to Hitler. Because we just want to be able to go to the doctor. Because we don't want to die of curable illnesses. That makes us like Hitler. And I tell you truly, it is hard not to let loose with a string of dirty words that I know I could at least, for the time being, get away with because we're on the interweb tubes. About such a thing. We've got a statute here in West Virginia called the Fighting Words Statute. It may be one of the few states that still has one. And it acknowledges that there are some instances in which words used against another human being have the moral and philosophical and emotional effect of striking a blow against someone else. So as an American citizen who never met the uncle, who was dug up out of French soil and brought back here to be buried in the hills and hollers where he lived, calling me Hitler for wanting to be able to go to the goddamn doctor, I don't know what better definition there is of a fighting word, short of talking about mama. That is where this country is. We have millions of citizens of this country who stand by, shoulder to shoulder, arms locked, and heels clicked, with a man who says that people who don't want to die quickly are Nazis. And thus we end the evening. Thank you to everyone for making sure that the horn will continue broadcasting. Thank you all. Thank you to our all volunteer staff, Lottie and Sparky and Texas Betsy in the chat room, our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thank you to John Fox. Thank you to Ben Birch. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Cold River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, and acact.org. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you.
Rick Smith is next on the Horn.